today's fast-paced information age, we are constantly being bombarded with books, articles, and materials we need to not only read, but absorb and quickly comprehend to further our careers and personal lives. It can oftentimes get overwhelming. What do I read? What do I get rid of? What do I skim over? Well, now you'll be able to read and comprehend all materials equally, because you will gain the ability to read faster than you've ever imagined. You will not only possess the skills to read and decipher materials quickly, but also how to comprehend and absorb all materials quickly. And even better than that, you'll have fun in the process. This program will show you how to do all this and more. With Howard Berg as your instructor, you'll learn how to quickly read and comprehend technical material, educational material, pleasure reading, letter reading, anything your eyes come in contact with. Howard will even teach you how to read through your computer quicker. You'll learn hand motions, memory skills, learning levels, types of reading, schema, skimming, and everything you need to understand and enjoy everything you read. Howard will help you to evaluate where your reading skills are currently at, then take you to the next level and beyond with simple how-to steps. Howard not only makes learning speed reading practical, as we said before, he makes it fun as well. And now, the Nightingale Conan Corporation is pleased to bring you the world's fastest reader, Howard Berg.
Welcome to Maximum Speed Reading. I'm Howard Berg, the world's fastest reader, and it's my pleasure to introduce you to the wonderful world of speed reading and accelerated learning. We live in an age of information where what you learn is what you earn. Look at the successful people around you. Do they have a little information or a lot of information? Look at the mega successes like Donald Trump and Bill Gates. Do they strike you as people with a little information or a lot of information? The average person today, learning has become a major challenge. I was reading a report by Merrill Lynch, and it said that one-third of 17-year-olds could not place the nation of France on a world map. That only 1 in 10 high school graduates can write a reasonably coherent paragraph. And yet the information that we're learning determines our ability to be successful in a world where the global economy is now based upon information. The way that we learn and the way that we retain information has remained basically unchanged for many centuries. In fact, St. Bonaventure mentioned how his teacher, the Bishop of Milan, was amazing because he could actually read without moving his lips. And all the centuries that have elapsed since the time of the Bishop of Milan, the big change is fewer people are moving their lips. Well, more information has been generated in the last century than all of previous human history. More data is published each year than all of the published materials up until the year 1800. So it's no longer an option to learn how to read faster and remember more. It's an indispensable skill. As the fastest reader in the world, my reading claim was published in the 1990 Guinness Book of World Records. I developed this program to solve my learning and reading needs. I attended the State University of New York at Binghamton, where I majored in biology. During my junior year, I got very interested in how the mind worked, and I decided I wanted to also major in psychology. But I hadn't taken a single psychology course, and I was going into my senior year. In order to accomplish this, I would have to take the entire 4-year psychology program in just 1 year, or basically 6 science courses a term. I was told this would be impossible, especially for me because I had a B- average. And that's when it hit me. After attending college and school for almost 18,000 hours, count up the hours from elementary school, intermediate school, high school and college, and your study time, it's close to 18,000 hours. No one had ever taught me how to learn. How many of you have had that same experience? School tells us what to learn. It gives us the content that we need to learn. But when did it ever explain why you could turn on the radio, listen to a few bars of a song you haven't heard in years, and instantly remember the words to a song like Michelle or Day Tripper without even having read the lyrics? You can remember the words to I Shot the Sheriff even if you don't want to. And yet, after reading a book, 15 minutes later, you can't remember the title and who wrote it. There just seemed to be no sense to the fact that our brain was remembering so much information that wasn't relevant and wasn't able to retain things that actually mattered. And as a result of exploring how the mind works, I developed this ability to read between 80 and 90 pages a minute, completed a 4-year psychology program in a single year, and then I went on to teach in New York City for 10 years. Because I hadn't majored in education, but in psychology and biology, I had to take courses in graduate school, and I took them in the psychology of reading. So maximum speed reading is a composite of these three areas. Psychology, how do we learn? Biology, how does the mind work? And the psychology of reading, learning how to read text. And we're about to embark on an exciting adventure together where all the information that I've learned that's made me the fastest reader in the world will be shared with you. And as you begin using the same strategies and methodologies, I think you're going to be amazed at the success and the abilities that I unlock within you. Let's begin by learning a little about how to use the program. First, there's a workbook. The workbook provides the visual information you need to follow along in these sessions. Then there's a videotape. The videotape describes the hand motions and also offers a demonstration of how I read. I would recommend viewing the videotape before beginning the initial part of this program. As soon as this introduction is completed, go view the videotape. Once you finish the videotape, you're going to go back to these sessions and follow along in your workbook. So you'll be back in a moment after viewing your videotape. Welcome back. Now let's learn how to select the right text for use in this program. The basic rule is simple. We're trying to learn a new skill. So we don't want the book to confuse us. We're not trying to learn a new book and a new skill at the same time. Quantum physics, existentialist philosophy, organic chemistry, calculus are definitely the wrong books to be learning how to speed read in. You can learn to study in these books effectively, and I will cover that in this program. But while learning the program, the rule is if the book confuses you while reading it slowly, it's probably the wrong book to use to speed up. You want a book that has no unfamiliar vocabulary and no unfamiliar ideas, so the bulk of your attention is on the new skill rather than the text. And here are a few books that I think you'll find ideal for that need. A book on a very familiar subject. For example, a biologist can choose a biology book, or a historian, a history book. Or perhaps a book on a subject you once studied and completely understood. For example, a high school text containing no unfamiliar ideas or vocabulary. Or perhaps you might choose a book you once read and found easy to understand. I do recommend using a non-fiction book that has ideas and concepts rather than a fiction book for learning how to speed read. And I will cover how to read fiction for maximum speed and enjoyment later in the program. Once you've found the ideal book, return to this program. Next, let's learn how to set up our study schedule. This is not a motivational program, and so it should not be attempted to be learned in a car. You wouldn't try to learn how to swim in a car. You wouldn't try to learn how to type in a car. In the same way, you won't want to learn maximum speed reading while driving. The best way to learn this is seated at a table for 4 hours. You can go in an evening from 6 to 10 p.m., or perhaps you could do this on a weekend from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. There are several breaks given on the audio portion of this program, so you will have ample opportunity to relax. Now let me quickly review with you what we'll be covering in your maximum speed reading program. First, we're going to measure your initial reading speed, so we can determine how rapidly you read now and compare it with the amazing speed you'll have in just a few short hours from now. Then we're going to learn some strategies for increasing the rate at which we view text. for the bulk of that time, you won't be able to read. And this is done deliberately. You might wonder, well, why would I want to definitely confuse you? And the reason is simple. When you study psychology and you want to recondition a response to a familiar pattern, it's easier to change the pattern if a subject is slightly confused or disoriented. If you're doing something you've done comfortably all your life, and then you're suddenly expected to do it totally differently, your brain will fight the change. If you're slightly confused and nothing seems to be working, your brain will be more receptive to doing it a different way. So we definitely want to get you slightly confused so we can quickly make the change to a faster way of viewing text. Next, we'll learn how the mind actually reads. And that's one of the big differences between maximum speed reading and other reading programs. Most reading programs are very mechanical. They have you rubbing pages and viewing text and gradually increasing your reading speed. And that does work. The problem is when you encounter something new, strange, and unfamiliar, your brain won't learn it at that speed. And so the instinct is to slow down to learn it. And when you did it in the old programs, you eventually ended up losing your speed because you had to read quickly all the time to sustain the new reading rate. Maximum speed reading will teach you a more psychologically based method for reading. So you can slow down when you need to and speed up when you want to. And that gives you more flexibility and ability to adjust to each type of reading. For example, reading for pleasure isn't the same as studying how to perform surgery. If a surgeon used the methods of the person relaxing with a novel, they'd kill the patient. If the person relaxing with a novel used the surgeon strategy, they'd kill the enjoyment. The beauty of maximum speed reading is it's a very flexible program. Unlike most programs that have a one-size-fits-all mentality, I'm going to give you a variety of options and choices throughout the program that you can adapt to you as an individual so that whatever it is you need to accomplish while reading and learning, you can use the perfect strategy that works for you, even though no one else might be using that exact same strategy. So that's one of the benefits of this program. It's easy to use because it's flexible and adjusts to your learning style and strategies. Once we learn how to read and how the mind understands text, we'll learn some more methods for speeding up and how to link this ability to read to viewing text at a higher speed. There's sort of an interesting contradiction. One might expect to first learn how to speed up, and that will increase their reading. We go backwards. First, we learn how to view text at a higher rate, and then using the psychology of reading, we learn how to make sense out of what we're seeing at the higher rate. You might wonder, why do I do it this way? It takes less time, and experience has shown me the results are much better and more lasting. Next, we're going to learn, what are we trying to read? How many times have you gone to an important meeting or taken an important exam only to find the questions you expected weren't asked, and everything you glossed over or skimmed was the 50-point essay at the end or the serious question the client had you needed to close them? Well, how did that make you feel? And what about the fact you spent all those hours learning something and it didn't give you the outcome you expected? Many students measure their learning success in terms of how long they read or how many pages were studied. And I tell you, both are irrelevant. What matters is, what did you understand, how well did you learn it, and how will you use that information in the future? So we're going to learn a strategy for anticipating that other people expect us to learn. We're also going to learn how to read in a variety of situations. We'll learn how to read for pleasure. We'll learn how to read to learn on our own, how-to books. We'll learn how to study, and we'll learn a strategy for learning very technical materials like calculus and medicine and law. So you'll have the exact methods and strategies you need for succeeding in whatever it is that you're going to be reading. And then we're going to learn how to lock in the information that we're finding at these higher speeds by using accelerated memory strategies and study skills. I'll also teach you a note-taking strategy that has created tremendous success in the Dallas area, and I'll describe it to you in more detail when we get to it. Now we're ready to calculate your initial reading speed. I'm going to time you for 1 minute, and you're going to read in the text, the titled text for measuring your reading speed. When the minute is up, I want you to look at the number in the left margin on the line you were reading, and multiply that number by 10, which means put a zero on the end, and that will be your initial reading speed. So open up to the text in your workbook, get comfortable, and read the way you've read your entire life. Ready? Begin. Terrific. Now, I'd like you to look at the number in the left margin and multiply that by 10. Write that down in your workbook, and later we'll refer back to it when we again measure your reading speed, and amazingly, it'll be probably 100% or greater in just a few short hours from now. Now, the range of normal reading is between 150 and 400 words per minute. So there's a very high likelihood your speed was in that range. Some of you might be higher, and some might be lower. It doesn't become a serious problem if it's lower, unless it drops below 100 words per minute. That shows a very slow reading rate. And while I can help you to improve your reading speed, I'm not here to teach you how to read. Often, when people have very low reading speeds, it's because they're reading in a second language, and the issue is building a bigger vocabulary. When we get to the memory portion of maximum speed reading, I will teach you some strategies for rapidly creating a larger vocabulary, which should solve the problem for many of you. So now we're ready to begin the maximum speed reading program. Let's begin by learning some simple hand motions that'll help us to increase the rate at which we view text. People often ask me, why do you use your hands? When we're reading, we tend to look at certain words many times. One of these problems is called visual regression, and it sounds like this. I went to the store. Many people have a tendency to look back and reread words over and over and over again. Or if something exciting is seen in text, they read it again. Or they slow down because it made them feel good. These are not good speed-up strategies. The hand helps to force the eye to continuously scan new text more visually. So the hand plays an important part in learning how to read. And we're going to learn how to use the hand now in the maximum speed reading program. We're going to learn several different hand motions. The thing to know is that your hand needs to go from the left to the right margin on the page, completely across, not down the middle. Many speed reading programs recommend going down the middle. I believe that's a mistake. As you grow older, I'll be 53 this year, and as you grow older, your eyes change. The peripheral vision becomes less and less reliable. The text at the sides and the edges of the page tend to get blurry and out of focus. And there's a good chance you might miss an important chunk of information. Moving your hand completely across from left to right margin eliminates that problem because your eye scans the entire line of text. In a small book, like a textbook that has columns, or a magazine, or a newspaper, you can go down the middle because the sides are so close to the middle, it doesn't require any peripheral vision to be successful. For the purposes of today's exercises, I would like you to go completely across the line, even if you're in a text that has very small pages or tight columns. Once you've mastered this method, it's easy to transfer to going down the center in tight text. On the other hand, it's more difficult to go from going down the center in tight text to a full-size page. So make your primary hand motion go completely across from left to right margin. Now, your hand can have three positions relative to your eye. Your eye can go behind your hand, following the text as your hand goes from left to right. Your eye can look in front of your hand, where your hand is about to travel as it goes from left to right. Or your eye can look directly above your hand as your hand goes from left to right. And I demonstrated all of this for you on the videotape. If you haven't taken the time yet to view the videotape as I've recommended, this would be an excellent time to do so. If you have, let's continue. Find the position that's most comfortable for you. It really doesn't matter which method you use as much as that you're comfortable when you're using the method. If you miss a word, continue moving your hand. Do not go back to see the word again. If you're missing many words, it means you're trying to go too rapidly, too early in the program, or you've chosen the wrong book. A book that has many confusing and unfamiliar words was not acceptable for these exercises. Let's begin practicing these simple techniques using Hand Motion 1's template found in your workbook. I've taken a selection from the famous fairy tale Beauty and the Beast. Notice how the arrows are going from the left to the right side of the page. You could put your hand on the arrow and move it from the left to the right side with your eye either behind your hand or in front of your hand, or put your hand slightly below the line and look above your hand. Find what works best for you. Read at your top speed for comprehension. Now, what does that mean? For now, comprehension means you understand what you're reading as you read it. It doesn't mean if I quizzed or tested you on it later, you'd retain it. Those are skills we will be covering later in the program. So as long as your understanding is there, go as quickly as possible. If your understanding is not there, you're going too quickly and slow it down a bit. Practice doing this on the page with Beauty and the Beast, and when you're done, turn your recording back on. Well, terrific. You started to learn how to use your hand to coordinate the way that you read. The next skill we're going to look at is how to read backwards. This is something that many people get agitated over. Let me tell you what I mean by reading backwards. I don't mean literally reading words backwards. For example, in your workbook, we have the first sentence saying, many people are surprised to learn they could read text forward and backward. Well, I'm not reading it backward and forward text. Read, can they learn to surprise our people many? Sounds like a Beatle album. That's not our goal. The goal is actually to look for patterns, and I will be teaching you more about patterns in the next section. What we need to do is just simply move our hand from the left to the right and then the right to the left. Now, we can, in fact, in many cases, read this way. Many languages are backwards. Hebrew is backwards. Many Asiatic languages are written backwards. In fact, many of them are written vertically and backwards. No one says the book's broken. It's convention in English that has us reading from left to right. That's how we were taught when we were very young. But as you're walking around in the day, do you stop and say, I can't see, except if I look left to right? Do your eyes go from right to left looking at the scenes around you? Do you suddenly get disoriented? Of course not. Why should text be any different? Text is pictures. Pictures called letters, and groupings called words, and groupings called sentences, and groupings called paragraphs. And why should those pictures be disorienting, looking at them from right to left, when all the other pictures we see throughout the day are scanned both from left to right and from right to left? So the fact is, many people can read this way. They just don't know it. Also, the faster you go, the easier it gets. Imagine if your hands were right in front of your eyes. You couldn't see anything. But if you rapidly moved your hands back and forth like a fan blade, suddenly they wouldn't be blocking your eyes. Well, the same thing's true of reading backwards. The faster you go, the easier it gets. Like a movie. A movie has about 24 pictures a second. At that speed, your brain can't see 24 individual pictures. So what it does is it fuses the information into a continuous stream that appears to be moving. The same way, as your hand goes back and forth more and more rapidly, you stop seeing individual words and you begin seeing more pictures or images. Now, not everyone can read backwards. Many people can and many can't. So why am I teaching it? Well, as I mentioned at the beginning, I teach a variety of strategies, and this is one many people can do. Maybe it's you. So why learn to read backwards? One, it speeds you up quickly and effectively. As your hand goes from left to right and we're reading, most of us have to go back to the left and start all over again at the beginning of the next line. But if your hand was to be moving your eye back and forth, then as you're going from the right to the left, you'd be reading. So you'd actually double your speed immediately. Of course, as every other line doesn't make any sense, there's no advantage to it. However, there is an exercise that we'll be doing very shortly. This exercise requires you to read 4 times for 16 total minutes. In the first minute, you're going to read at your top comprehension speed. Then you're going to double that speed and then triple it. Well, obviously, if you double and triple your best speed, you won't be able to comprehend. Well, why do we do that? Do you ever go to a ball game and you notice that sometimes the batter swings 2 or 3 bats for several minutes in the warm-up box, and then when they actually swing the one bat, what happens? They swing it harder. Their muscles are tricked into expecting the bat to weigh more. They swing the bat harder, they hit the ball further. Well, your brain isn't a muscle. But by deliberately overwhelming you for 2 minutes with too much information, more than you can understand and comprehend, it struggles to work harder, like a muscle with extra weight. In the fourth minute, when you go back to reading, your new speed with comprehension will be faster because you exercised your brain to work harder than it ever has before. So I have to deliberately give you too much information for 2 minutes. And backwards reading is perfect. Since you immediately double your speed and you have no idea what you're reading, it's going to confuse you. And that's exactly what we want temporarily. The good news is it's very temporary. And when it's done and you go back to reading, your speed actually goes faster. For the first time in your life, you don't know what you're doing it right. That's very rare in our life. So I wanted to mention that to you, so as we begin reading backwards, even if you don't use it for reading, it isn't one of the goals of this program to make you a backward reader, just to give you different options. Even if you don't use it for reading, you will use it for those exercises found in this program. And if they do nothing more than speed up your reading rate forwards to a much higher level with comprehension, they've accomplished their goal. The fact that many of you will find that you can actually read like this is a perk and not a goal of this program. So now let's begin learning how to read backwards. In your workbook, you see a page that says sample text. There's a line that's squiggling down the page and continues on the next page in your workbook. This is going to help us to learn how to read backwards. It's a very simple exercise. I'd like you to put your hand on the word who. And you're going to go from left to right, and then from right to left on the next line, going one line at a time. But I want you to go very rapidly. Since you won't be able to read, you might as well speed up. So I want you to go left to right, right to left, left to right, right to left, left to right, right to left. We're going to begin this drill in a moment. And when you're done doing the drill, return to the audio portion of your program. Ready? Begin. Well, right now you probably haven't got a clue what you just read. Perfect. For the first time in your life, not knowing what you're doing was successful. Let's face it, you probably have gone in books on your own without my help and gotten confused. So it's nothing new. I'm not asking you to read. What I'm actually looking for is the coordination between your hand, your eye and your brain. You're forcing your eye to go quickly through text, and your brain is saying, I don't get it, and wants to slow down. It's getting confused. Perfect. Fortunately, this confusion is very temporary, and we're going to very rapidly learn new skills throughout this program to eliminate that. But think of it this way. If you can't look at a book quickly without even having to know what you're looking at, how do you expect to read faster and learn faster? At some point, we have to go quicker and more rapidly than you did when we started the program. And when we first start doing this, there's going to be some confusion. Think of it as swimming. I taught swimming for almost 18 years as a Red Cross volunteer, and we teach it in baby steps. The first lesson is how to blow bubbles. And when you're teaching an adult how to blow bubbles, and they watch someone flipping and doing laps in the next lane, they look at you and say, wait a minute, what kind of scam is this? That's swimming, I'm blowing bubbles. And I would say to them, watch closely. They're swimming and blowing bubbles. Because if you can't blow bubbles, you can't put your face in the water. If you can't put your face in the water, you can't float. And if you can't float, you can't swim. Well, maximum speed reading follows the same intelligence as those Red Cross programs. We take baby steps. We learn little pieces to each of the skills. Learning how to look at a book backwards and forwards is one skill. Later, I'll teach you strategies for turning pages more rapidly and other skills. And when we put all the little skills together, kicking, blowing, bubbles, moving our arms, with swimming, when we put all the little skills of the maximum speed reading program together with speed reading, right now we're learning fragments of a bigger skill. The fragments themselves don't work. When we put them all together, the results are there. The beauty of this approach is it's effortless. It's easy. And despite the fact that there's a little period of time where nothing seems to be working, when we finally get all the little pieces put together into a stroke, it works just fine. So you will find in a very short time from now that you're doing just great. Now notice the line going down the page in your book. This line simulates what would happen if your hand had ink in it. Now it doesn't have ink in it, but if it did, and you were to rub it above and below each paragraph on the page, going from left to right, it would leave a pattern that looks exactly like the one in this book. Well, most books won't have a pattern in them, but by putting your hand on that line and rubbing back and forth and down to the bottom of the next page, you will experience the first major backwards hand motion. What I want you to do now is put your hand on top of the line. I want you to imagine it's not your hand, but it's you. A little metaphor, a little existentialist philosophy here. Your hand is on the line, and there's a lion standing next to you that wants to eat you. And the only way to save your life is to run down the path, the line in the book, to the bottom of the next page. You'll notice that the bottom of the next page, the last two lines are very tight, and the lines that are going up to it are larger, encompassing an entire paragraph. The title lines on the bottom of the next page represent what most people do when reading for comprehension. The big chunks are more representative of what we do when we're skimming. Both patterns are important in maximum speed reading. Since we're learning patterns right now, I'm introducing both of them at the same time. Later, we'll be able to take advantage of this experience to speed up with comprehension. For now, all I'm interested in is getting you confused and having your eye go back and forth and down, scanning the entire page from top to bottom. So put your hand on the line, and when I say begin, you're going to run down to the bottom of the next page. And when you're done, I want you to return to this audio program. Ready? Begin. Terrific. Well, there's a very good chance you have no idea what you just read. So congratulations, you're doing it correctly. Going to teach you one more hand motion that'll help you to speed up. And this motion is very simple. You put your hand on top of the page where it says tips for backwards reading and have it go back and forth and down, side to side, instead of in loops, back and forth and down, side to side, as if you were cleaning the page off. And when you get to the bottom of the page, you're done. So that's an alternate to looping. Let's try that. Go back and forth and down, and when you're done, you're going to put the audio program back on. Ready? Begin. So far, we've learned three hand motion strategies, going from left to right, one line at a time, left to right, one line at a time, and we've learned to loop, going over and under each block of text, or to go back and forth and down. Now, which of these methods that you'll use is up to you. You might find in text that's very familiar and easy, all the methods work. You might find in very technical and confusing text that going one line at a time from left to right works best for you. By giving you the ability to choose what optimizes your learning, you will be able to maximize the outcome you're getting in each subject. But that will not happen at this point in the program. We're too early on in the program to be getting any decent comprehension. You will be getting it momentarily. What I need to do now is to practice to get you to read at very, very high speed. Now, up till now, you may have been using either your left or your right hand. Let me show you now how to choose which hand works best for you. I'd like you to open up in your familiar book, and what I want you to do is just go back and forth and down the way you just did, using just your left hand. Go back and forth and down on the left page, and then go back and forth and down on the right page. And then repeat that without flipping the page. Go back and forth and down on the left page, and then go back and forth and down on the right page. As fast as I'm going to have you go. Ready? Begin. Back and forth and 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 back and forth. Terrific. Keep that pace going until you're done reading both pages. Now, when you're done, you'll probably find you have very little comprehension. That's fine. We're not looking at comprehension right now. We're just learning to coordinate the brain, the hand, and the eye. Now, what you'll find if you slide your right hand up to the corner of the right page and grasp it before you even begin rubbing on the left side of the book, you'll be able to turn the page immediately when your hand gets to the bottom of the right page. You can view this on the videotape if you haven't done so already. So I want you to go back and forth and down with your left hand, and back and forth and down with your left hand on the right page, and then turn. And then grab the right page on the next section and rub back and forth and down, left page, right page. Let's practice that. Back and forth and down on the left page. Back and forth and down on the left page. Very quickly. And then go back and forth and down on the right page. Back and forth and down on the right page and turn. Now, quickly grab the right page on the next section and begin doing it again. Back and forth and down on the left, back and forth and down on the left, back and forth and down on the left. Now begin doing it on the right. Back and forth and down, back and forth and down, back and forth and down. Continue practicing this for several pages, and when you're done, come back to the audio portion of your program. Ready? Begin. Terrific. Now, some of you may have found using your left hand uncomfortable, and that's perfectly normal. Many right-handed people find the left hand awkward to use. The fact is that most people do use both hands. Because text turns from right to left in English, many people find it best to turn the pages with their right hand and rub the book with their left hand. What we're going to do now is learn how to do it with only our right hand if you found your left hand uncomfortable. It's an option. And what we do is we take our right hand and we rub the left side of the book. Then we rub the right side of the book. We come up and turn. We rub the left, we rub the right, come up and turn. Rub the left, rub the right, come up and turn. Only do this exercise if you found using your left and right hand uncomfortable. And when you're done practicing it, turn back on your audio portion of your program. Ready? Begin. One of the strategies I found that helps to keep the book from flipping and flopping as you're reading is when you're reading with your left hand on the left side of the page, keep your hand straight, up and down, as I demonstrated on the video. When you're reading on the right side of the page with your left hand, instead of keeping your left hand straight up and down, if you slightly bend it, so it's a little bit on a 45-degree angle, it's a little crooked, then the heel of the left hand helps to keep the pages from flopping on the left side of the book when you're reading on the right side. And if you're not sure what I'm saying, look at the videotape again, because I demonstrated it very clearly on the videotape. In the same way, when you're using your right hand on the left side of a book, if you slightly bend your hand so it's on an angle, about a 45 degree angle rather than straight up and down, it'll help eliminate the flopping of the book as well. Again, I've demonstrated this on the videotape that accompanied this program. Now we're ready to practice reading at very high speeds in your text. Our goal here is not for comprehension. The goal here is to be able to double and triple later in that exercise that we're going to be doing. So I need to get you to view text at a very high rate. There's an interesting relationship between reading and learning. Data is just raw chunks. For example, the number 1900 is data. What does it mean? It means nothing. Is it 1900 pounds? Is it the year 1900? Is it $1,900? $1,900, 1900 pounds, the year 1900, that's information. But the number 1900 is data. Well, text is data. And as we chunk it into information, it becomes meaningful. When we're reading very rapidly for the first time, we're seeing the data, it's a blur, but we're not getting the information, the meaning. But that's the first step to being able to see the information later. So the fact that right now you're getting a blur rather than an interesting flow of information is not only normal, it's expected. And if that's happening, you're doing it totally correctly. We're going to begin practicing viewing text at 5 seconds a page by rapidly moving our hand back and forth and down, either wiping or looping, whichever works best for you. What's important is when I count to five, your hand is at the bottom of the page that you're reading. Incidentally, if your book has columns instead of individual pages of information, count each column as if it was a page. So we go back and forth and down the column, back and forth down the next column, and back and forth down the next column rather than the whole page. That should help if you're using a text that has columns in it. Now turn to the first page of chapter 1. And remember, when I get to 5, your hand is at the bottom of the page. We're not concerned now with comprehension. In fact, the more confusion you're feeling, the better you're doing. We're trying to overwhelm the part of your brain that converts pictures into sounds, data into information. We're making it work harder so it will read quickly and better later. Right now we're just working on building up its strength. At the top of the first page of chapter 1. Ready? Begin. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Next page. 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 And stop. Now at this point, what you're probably having is clean books, dirty hands, and no understanding. That's perfectly normal at this particular point in the program. I want to double the rate at which you're viewing the text so we can go even quicker. Since you didn't know what you were reading before, doubling the speed isn't going to affect comprehension. It's just going to increase the rate at which your eye scans text. Go to the first page of chapter 1, and we're going to view the text in 2-second increments. I'm going to say 1-1,000, 2-1,000, and when I'm done, your hand is at the bottom of the page. And again, I demonstrated this on the videotape, so you'd be able to see how it works. Ready? Begin. 1-1,000, 2-1,000, next page. 1-1,000, 2-1,000, next page. 1-1,000, 2-1,000, next page. 1-1,000, 2-1,000, next page. 1-1,000, 2-1,000, stop. Perfect. What you've learned to do now is to coordinate your hand, your eye, and your brain. Your brain is saying, slow down, I don't understand what I'm reading. But that doesn't matter. In fact, your brain might be saying, I'll never learn to do this. It's too confusing. It's too hard. That's normal when you experience the frustration of not understanding something. The good news is, ultimately, you're going to learn how to remember and comprehend better than you did before. This is just a temporary stage we have to go through to get to that excellent stage in just a few hours from now. Let's continue with our lesson. On the next page in your workbook, I've created a mind map which visually summarizes what we've just learned about backwards reading. You might want to take a moment to review it before we continue. Once you have, we'll move to the next section of our program. Well, congratulations. We're almost ready to begin our first reading drill. Now, the reading drills are labeled in your set, and you'll be able to find each drill by its number. This is going to be drill number one. Before we go to drill number one, let me tell you what you'll be doing. I'd like you to get a paper clip so you can mark off where your starting point will be for each drill. And you're going to clip the first page of chapter one to get started. Then I will time you for 1 minute and you'll read at your peak comprehension rate. Don't go faster than you could read. Don't go slower than you could read. Go as quickly as you could read and understand. And then you're going to go back to where the clip is and double your speed. You're going to be going twice as fast and not comprehending anything. In the third minute, you're going to go back to the paperclip again and triple your speed, going three times faster. This is an approximation. It doesn't have to be exact. In the fourth minute, you're going to go back to the paperclip and read again for 1 minute at your peak comprehension rate. Now, for the very, very first minute, I want you to read going forwards only. In the second and third minute, I want you to go backwards and forwards. I won't remind you to stop reading backwards when you get to the fourth minute on purpose. If you're so sure you can't read backwards, you won't. The questions you ask and the state of mind you have affect your learning. For example, if you say, why am I a loser and why doesn't anyone like me, your brain will tell you. You probably should have said, how can I be more lovable and successful? And if you say, why am I so stupid? Why don't I understand this? Your brain will tell you why you're an idiot instead of how to succeed. If you ask yourself, how could I learn this? What do I need to make this work for me? Your brain can do that as well. Well, the same thing's true here. If you say, well, I can't read backwards, you won't. So I deliberately have you go backwards for 2 minutes and don't remind you to stop. Some of you will just keep going in the fourth minute and find, surprise, you can read backwards. You just didn't know it. Others will find they can't read backwards. They should not read backwards and should only go forwards. So the first and the fourth minute of each of these drills will be read for comprehension. The second and third is for speed. When you've completed the fourth minute, wherever you finish, move the paperclip to that page. And that will become the first page for the next 4 minutes of drills. And again, you'll keep going back to the paperclip for the final minute, and when you finish, you're going to move the paperclip again. So it's really very simple. And I'll explain this again when we begin the drill. I will tell you in each step what you should be doing. So now go to your program, find exercise number one, and when you're done doing that exercise, return to your audio program. Congratulations! You've completed the first stage of maximum speed reading. You've learned how to use your hand to move yourself more rapidly through text. Next, let's learn how do we comprehend text. Isn't it amazing? You can drive in a car at 60, 70 miles an hour and read the road effortlessly. And not just in front of you, but in back and on both sides simultaneously while reading the road signs and looking for hazards. And not only could we read in all directions at 60 to 70 miles an hour, the same time we're looking at our instrument gauges for gas and speed, and is our engine overheating? At the same time, a person can read the road at 60 to 70 miles an hour. The average reading speed is only about 200 words per minute. Isn't that amazing? Plus, when you think about it, when someone's reading the road in a car, they're usually so bored, even though they're taking in so much continuously changing information, they turn on the radio, they make cell calls, and they talk to friends. Why is it a brain that can read and process visual information while driving reads so slowly in text? It's really very simple. When we initially learn to read, we learn to read words as letters. We might say D-O-G, and that spells dog. Now, you might be surprised, because I'm from Texas, to learn that I'm not a native. I was originally from a place called Brooklyn. It's a place internationally renowned for people with good diction and keen intellect. So that I can't help you with. The good news is you already have this ability to read quickly. In fact, when I'm home in Texas, they have a strange way of pronouncing dog. They say dog. And I've tried very hard to give them the correct pronunciation, and it just hasn't paid off. They still haven't gotten it. The fact is, you don't see letters anymore when you read. When's the last time you read a book and said, what a great book, look at all the interesting letters, so many Z's and Q's, the guy's a genius. Letters have disappeared into groupings called words. And next they disappear into groupings that are larger. The word hot is one word. The word dog is another word. Hot dog is not actually a hot dog, unless you're in parts of Asia. And then if you bite the bun and it starts to bark, you might consider the vegetable meal as an alternative. Look at the word United States of America. That's four words. It's almost the width of a column in a textbook or in a newspaper. But you don't see United and then States and then of and America. You see one country. And that's the secret. You see, when we read the road, we take it in visually. We take it in as a pattern, as one chunk of data. When we look at the picture in our book, we see two men actually standing. We see their slacks and the creases in them. We see their hats, their pencil. We don't just see the tip of the pencil. We take it in as a whole, as a picture. But when we read text, instead of seeing words on the page as a painting, which is what they are, they're symbols painted on a page, we take them in as a conversation. Reading is the only visual activity where our eyes are used to hear something instead of see it. Vision is spatial. We take things in collectives, in chunks. Look at a painting, we see the whole thing instantly. Listen to a song on the radio, and we hear it in time as each note is played over a sequence in time. Reading is much more like looking at a painting than hearing a song. But the way we were trained to read, we hear the page as a series of sounds in our head, as an imaginary voice converts the words back into sound bites, instead of seeing it as a sequence of movies, as images. By learning to be a bit more visual and a little less auditory, I don't mean you don't hear anything, you still hear, but you're more selective about what you choose to hear, and I'll show you specifically what to select to hear. Immediately you'll find your reading speed goes up dramatically. Now let's learn how the brain actually decodes text. When I took courses in the psychology of reading, one of the key elements they mentioned was a concept called schema. Now, schema is a fancy word because scientists like fancy words. You can't have a sore throat, you have to have laryngitis. It can up the bill a little bit by simply changing the word. Well, in a very similar way, schema is very simple in its meaning, even though it sounds strange. Schema is your database. It's your familiarity. It's your map of the world. But just more simply, schema is your life experiences. And when people write books, they make suppositions about those experiences. If I'm reading a book, and the book says the woman wore a red dress, as a writer, I expect you to know what a woman is, what a dress is, what red is. Because if I have to explain it, where does it end? A woman is a female. What's a female? A double X chromosome. What's an X? What's a chromosome? Somewhere, the map of the writer and the map of the reader have to align, or comprehension doesn't occur. And often, it's because of poor writing. I'm sure many of you had the experience of reading a book, like a calculus book, and you get a phrase in it like, it's obvious, or it's easy to see, or anyone would know. When you look at it and say, I must be the biggest idiot in the world. I don't see it, it's not obvious, and it's certainly not easy. See, what's happened is, the person writing this technical book has spent a lifetime building up a map of the subject. So their brain is looking at this simple book as an easy understanding, whereas the map of the student or the learner is a blank page with nothing to refer to. And so what a good writer should have said is, it's obvious this is true because, and then told you what was in their map that made it so obvious, so now you could install the same information in your map and make it easier to learn. Well, unfortunately, not everyone writes well. So we will develop in our program some strategies for compensating for bad suppositions made by writers. And I will introduce that later in the program. Ultimately, it is schema that will help us to increase our reading speed dramatically and also to boost our understanding of text. Now, another important goal of this program is not just to make you a faster reader. To me, it isn't important to read faster if you don't understand. You can't understand and retain it. The first step is to understand that there's three different types of information that could be gleaned from text. The first is called literal. Literal information, by definition, is anything in print. That doesn't mean it's true. People can lie. You probably found that out already. Some people who lie have pens and type. Look at a typical magazine. There's four ads for the best-selling car in America, but they're all different cars. They can't all be best. One's good, one's better, one's probably best. But somehow the publisher, after getting a check from each of these advertisers, overlooks this impossibility. It doesn't matter. So literally, what's in print is what's there. It doesn't mean it's true. Literal information is often what needs to be learned. The names, the places, the dates, the facts, the statistics. And that's why, and this is the most important thing I've said so far in this program, that's why we always read with a purpose. Your brain is designed by nature to selectively focus upon what's most important in the environment. I'd like to do a simple experiment to demonstrate just what I mean. I want you to look around and make a mental photograph of everything colored green. Photograph it, memorize it, lock it into your memory. Now, I want you to close your eyes. I want you to recall everything in the room colored blue. Immediately your brain says, that's not fair. You said green. Exactly. Open your eyes. What happened? Everything that was green got bigger, brighter, closer, louder, more important. Everything else got dimmer and further away and harder to see. And that's exactly what happens when we read with a purpose. The things that matter appear bigger and brighter and closer, and our brain filters away things that have less relevancy. Your purpose might be, should I read this book? And that's a very valid purpose. How many times have you bought a book you thought would help you, only to find weeks later it was the wrong book? The beauty of maximum speed reading is you will learn a strategy for rapidly skimming a book to quickly ascertain if this book is even worth the time it might take to read before you waste several weeks. So literal information, we need a purpose. You wouldn't necessarily memorize the yellow pages unless you're Rain Man. And then you're not much fun at parties, so there's a downside. If you're looking at the periodical chart, if you're a chemist or a scientist who's going to use that data regularly, learning it might make sense. If you're an art major taking a required chemistry course or a science elective, why would you want to memorize it? You wouldn't need it, and by the time you would, you wouldn't remember it anyway. So your purpose helps to make the determination, what is it I actually want to learn? Implied information is not given. It's the information that we presuppose that you have. Suppose we would have a book like Moby Dick. Now, here's the problem. If you were born in Albuquerque and you lived in the desert your entire life, would your experience in Moby Dick be the same experience as someone who grew up in Portland, Maine, or San Francisco, where they may have done a lot of boating and fishing and actually been on the ocean? There's a difference between reading about a wave rolling under the decks and being on a boat where the wave is rolling under the deck. And so sometimes implied information can cause a certain amount of misunderstanding, although generally it isn't a big deal. For example, I wouldn't expect someone to tell me what a woman is. That's implied. And most of the time I'd be correct, and presuming the other person knows that. Inferential information, that's the high watermark of learning. It's taking the map you already have into the learning experience. For example, if your neighbor needs a triple bypass, and you read a book on how to perform open heart surgery, even if you memorize it, try to find a hospital that's going to let you use a scalpel and cut open their chest to do your altruistic deed. There is a big difference between reading a book on vascular surgery and being a surgeon, let alone a doctor. It takes years of specialized training, plus the book, plus other experiences, to make that book useful. Inferential learning is the whole. It's everything we know that we take to the reading experience. Inferential reading is your capacity to question or challenge what's in print, saying I agree or I don't agree, based upon your map. And sometimes your map is incorrect. A few years ago, an Australian gastroenterologist said that ulcers were not caused by excessive stomach acid secretion, as was commonly believed, but by bacteria. Well, this is unheard of. This one doctor is telling all these experts throughout the world they've got ulcers wrong. It's like telling a dentist they don't know what a cavity is. Gastroenterologist, a stomach and intestinal specialist, ulcers is one of the most common things they treat. He's telling them they've got it wrong. Well, he was attacked by all the other experts, including the drug companies that had a vested interest in some of the stomach medications. So they finally decided they were going to definitely teach this guy a lesson. They were going to repeat his experiment. And lo and behold, he was right. Today, the treatment for stomach ulcers is antibiotics. His approach was the right approach, but everyone else's map was different. Because they were so smart and had such good experience, it was inconceivable one person's map could be right. This isn't the first time something like this has happened. Not that long ago, it was considered unthinkable that the Earth wasn't flat and the sun went around the Earth. Today, of course, we know the Earth is round and the Earth goes around the sun, but to consider that as an option just a few centuries ago was a death sentence. So our maps aren't always right, and when we're reading inferentially, we not only want to question what we read, but also ask ourselves if new information requires us to reevaluate our previous map. Inferential reading is going beyond the scope of what's in print. It's reading a book like Art of the Deal by Donald Trump and finding out how to make $1 million doing what you do. It wasn't Trump's intention to empower you in your profession, but you inferred how to use some of his marketing and selling strategies in an unrelated field, and suddenly he became wealthy. To me, that's one of the real values of speed reading. Years ago, I taught high school in New York. It's a difficult job. Decided I wanted to move on. So I studied how to make programs and how to do talk shows, something that I didn't learn in biology and psychology. Now, I believe you can learn from a book, but one book might be a lucky guess or just one person's opinion. 10 books, that's a plan. I looked at the patterns that people had, their emotions, their attitudes, the resources. Now you've got a hologram. You've got 10 different people telling you how they accomplished something you want to do. To me, that's the beauty of speed reading. Most people struggle to read a book. When you read quickly, you could read many books in a very short time span and find the solutions to several people instead of a single person. And by using that information, you can suddenly become more successful. So if you're taking this program just to get your homework done quicker or speed up the work at work, I'd like you to look at the bigger picture. Our entire global economy has become based upon leveraging information. With a program like this, you have the opportunity to open up and take advantage of a world where what you know determines your ability to earn and be successful. And if you see that, you'll get even more from this program than simply a tool for reading. You might just find this program can change your entire life. And now on the next page in your workbook, I put together a mind map that summarizes the meaning of schema and the 3 levels of textual meaning. You may want to review this, and when you're done, we'll continue. Now, I'd like you to look at the fragment of a picture found in your book and tell me, what's the name of this picture? Is this picture valuable? Well, I'm sure many of you looked at this picture and said, whoa, that's the Mona Lisa. And of course it's valuable. And if you did so, I have a question. Look at the next page. How could you possibly have answered that question by only seeing about 10 to 15% of the data? By looking at a small chunk of the picture, not only did you know what the picture was, but it was a valuable picture. What I discovered when I was attending college is when the brain sees a tiny fragment of a very familiar pattern, and not only remembers the pattern that the fragment is part of, but any information you've learned about the whole pattern becomes available through the fragment, just as looking at a small piece of the Mona Lisa told you what the painting's name was and its value, so does this happen more and more often when we're reading. As adults, we tend to read books and subjects we're interested in or need to know about for our careers. There's two things we're going to be doing when we read. We're either using maps we already have, or we're creating new maps. Both skills are covered in maximum speed reading. You always read quickest where there is already a map established, where you don't have to learn new words, new ideas, and new vocabulary. You can go very, very rapidly using the patterns rather than the words. I will also teach you how to select what to learn when it's new and how to learn it and retain it and build the maps more rapidly. So no matter what you're doing, you'll always do it quicker than you did before. And interestingly, we don't just do this visually. We do this throughout the day. You're crossing the street. Suddenly you hear a horn. Do you get philosophical and say, is there really a truck or a bus coming, and walk anyway? The people who did that aren't taking the program. They're no longer with us. Your brain learned to identify a sound bite as representative of a potential threat and took action. And it's not just hearing, it's touch. Helen Keller was a brilliant woman who couldn't see. And yet, by touch, she learned everything she needed to know about the world. As visual people, we often underutilize some of these senses like touch and taste and smell when learning. But doesn't it make sense? The more senses we'd use, the more brain we would stimulate, and the faster we'd learn, and the easier we would be able to recall. And that's what the latest studies have suggested. And I will teach you strategies for using more of the brain senses to boost your understanding and comprehension. So before we're done with this program, you'll be remembering and retaining much better than before. And so even though initially your comprehension dropped down, the outcome will be, when we're finally done and have all the skills, it'll be much better than it used to be. Look at how word groupings create meaning. Words themselves do not create meaning in text. It's the groupings of words that make text meaningful. Let's look at some sentences that illustrate this point. The first one puts the emphasis on the word red. Red's red dog red read two books to me at the red light. Notice how many different meanings the word red had. It was the context of the sentence that made it meaningful. Now we're going to look at an emphasis on the word two. Don't you think that the two of you go too often to that place? Look at the emphasis on the word read. I read that the Egyptians could read books made from reeds. Now we'll put the emphasis on the word here. Did you hear that he went here to get his hair put back on? Now we'll put emphasis on the word frank. Frank was frank about how he wanted his frank to taste. And finally, the word Polish. Did you polish the Polish table lamp? In each case, it was the schema, the context, the grouping that made the words meaningful. On their own, words have no meaning. It's the patterns that create the meaning. And by learning how to use patterns more effectively, we could read bigger chunks with meaning. Let's learn how to use schematic meaningfulness. We have here an exercise that you will be reading that lacks any schematic clues. The best way to demonstrate how schema makes text meaningful is to take it out and then try to find the meaning. Even though the words in this exercise are simple and familiar, the meaning is not, because the clues your brain is searching for are missing. We're going to read a few of these sentences, and then I'm going to put a one-word title on, and watch how instantly the same words become instantly understandable, because that one-word title has schema or familiarity and puts the context around all the meaning and makes it decodable. Let's do it together. The procedure is actually quite simple. First, you arrange things into different groups. Of course, one pile may be sufficient, depending on how much there is to do. If you have to go somewhere else due to the lack of facilities, that's the next step. Otherwise, you're pretty well set. Right now, would you bet the ranch you know exactly what I mean? I think the answer is no. It's too vague. Your brain can't find the meaning. I'm going to put a one-word title over this and watch how that one word with familiarity, with schema, makes the text easy to decode. And that word is laundry. Laundry, the procedure is actually quite simple. First, you arrange things into different groups. Of course, one pile may be sufficient depending on how much there is to do. If you have to go somewhere else due to a lack of facilities, that's the next step. Otherwise, you're pretty well set. So where is the schema? What is the schema? The schema is the verbs and nouns, the people, places, things, and their actions. What made this passage confusing was non-specific verbs and nouns. Watch what happens when I make a few substitutions for vague words and put in specifics. Laundry. Doing laundry is actually quite simple. First, you arrange clothes into different groups. Of course, one pile of clothes may be sufficient, depending on how much there is to launder. If you have to go to a laundromat, due to a lack of a washing machine, that's the next step. Otherwise, you're pretty well set. Had any of those specific words appeared, the meaning would have been clear. Sometimes the problem is too much specificity. The word is not something that's in our map. It's not in our vocabulary. Take a biological term like Agilius phoenicius. Very specific. How much help does it give you in terms of meaning? Absolutely none. Let me show you how to handle technical words when writing. And I cover this in more detail in my advanced program. When you have a word that might be technical or unfamiliar to someone else, put in a comma right after it and say it again in plain English. An Agilius phoenicius, comma, a red-winged blackbird, comma, flew from its nest and grabbed a worm. Let me do that with Howard Berg. Howard Berg taught maximum speed reading. The world's fastest reader taught maximum speed reading. Howard Berg, comma, the world's fastest reader, comma, taught maximum speed reading. Do you notice how the third time, how much more meaningful it became? I repeated the subject, Howard Berg, twice by mentioning who he was, the world's fastest reader. When you're communicating information and you want it to be understood by others, put in a comma and say it again in English so there's no misinterpretation. When I'm reading to pick up the schematic clues, I make a cartoon balloon float in front of me, and these balloons have the familiar words we learn to search for in English. Who, what, where, when, why, and how. I'm constantly looking for that information. And they're not all equal. Who is a person? Where is a place? And when is a time? Those are pretty cut and dry. What is the big picture? And how is the details? For example, do you know what a surgeon does to unclog an artery? Probably you do. Do you know how to perform open heart surgery and unclog an artery? Unless you're a doctor, the answer is probably no. Do you know what a pilot does to land a 757? Probably you know what they do. Do you know how to land a 757? Sometimes the what is all you need. Many people end up cluttering their minds up with too much how that they'll never need and end up forgetting the things they actually needed to know. So it's very important to have a strategy to determine how much how do I need to know. Why is a little more confusing? Why goes to people's beliefs and values, and even if they tell you why, you don't know if they're telling the truth, so it's not always that cut and dry. So as much as possible, I'm trying to see a movie rather than hear a conversation. I'm seeing the where, I'm seeing the when, I'm seeing the why. Another thing that's important about reading is that English is a very phonetic language. Let me show you what I mean by an example. I'm going to give you a simple sentence. I didn't say she ate the sandwich. That seems pretty simple, doesn't it? Watch what happens when I inflect it and interpret the meaning each different way. I didn't say she ate the sandwich. What does that mean? Well, I didn't say it. Someone else did. I didn't say she ate the sandwich. What does that mean? I might have implied it, but I didn't actually say it. I didn't say she ate the sandwich. I said someone else ate the sandwich. I didn't say she ate the sandwich. Maybe I said she threw it away. I didn't say she ate the sandwich. I said she ate the apple. Do you notice how many different meanings that one sentence had simply by changing my inflection? Well, when many people write, they hear inflections in their head. But hearing them in your head and seeing them on paper is two different things. We don't capture inflection in our writing. And so if you run into a passage that's very important and confusing, one strategy you might consider is reading it aloud and changing the inflections. Now, this will slow you down, so I don't recommend doing it often. But if it's a critical passage and understanding is not occurring, perhaps this is one strategy that might make it more meaningful. Another thing that's important about reading and learning is to use more of the senses, as I implied earlier. Let me show you how that's done. I'm going to give you a history lesson, and I'm going to use the story of Paul Revere, and watch how we lock in the information. Paul Revere is standing next to Boston Harbor, and as he breathes in, he can smell the salt and taste it on his tongue coming off the bay. He looks up, and he sees across the bay in the steeple two bright, shining lanterns. The signal, the British are coming by sea. He hops on his horse, and he feels the saddle pressing against him. And as he begins to ride, he can hear the hooves against the cement. Probably cobblestones in those days. So he gets to the woods, becomes more muffled. He begins smelling the piney scent of the tree and the mustiness of the forest. And there in the distance, he sees dimly illuminated the house of a Minuteman. And as he grows closer, he says, "Grab your arms, the British are coming." Probably more like, "Grab your arms, the British are coming." And imagine all these things and compare them to what you might see in a history book. Paul Revere warned the Minutemen the British were coming. Where is your brain more interested, more engaged? When text is boring and uninteresting, and that can happen, it's up to you to change that by how you view it and experience it. If I'm reading about malaria in a biology book, not the most interesting subject, but instead of reading it, I experience the cramps and the fever and I visualize it. Won't I have a better opportunity later to remember it? Because I've experienced it. Years ago, I taught swimming. And one of the things they taught us to help people who were blind or had amputations or neuromuscular disorders, they splinted our legs and arms so they wouldn't bend. Then they blindfolded us and they took us to the diving board. And they walked us into the deep end of the pool. And when we hit the water, we couldn't see, we couldn't hear, and we had to wiggle without using our arms and legs to the shallow end without knowing where it was. I can tell you it was absolutely terrifying. They promised if we wiggled towards the concrete wall, someone would be there and prevent our heads from crashing into the cement. Have you ever had someone promise they'd be there when you really needed them? And what happened? And that was going through our heads as we were walking, swimming through the water. And afterwards, when I taught people who had car accidents or had lost a limb or were blind, I had so much more understanding of what they were feeling and sensing and fearing because I'd been through that same fear. I became a better teacher. That's what we want when you're reading. Make the book an experience rather than just a set of words on a page, and your brain will pay more attention and it'll have more reason to learn. Now let's go to the next sample text that has abundant schematic clues. This is the mirror image of the last exercise. The last exercise had lots of words and followed all the rules of prose and writing, but was difficult to interpret because the schema was lacking. Here, none of the rules of writing are observed. There's no grammar. There's no sentences. There's no paragraphs. But it's very rich in meaning because it has an abundance of schematic clues that make it meaningful. I'll read it aloud and we'll interpret it together. On July 28, 1903, a baby shop gets a check for $175 from Robert Cole. On October 1st, 1903, a hospital gets a check for $125 from Robert Cole. On November 1st, 1903, a physician gets a check for $475 from Robert Cole Sr. December 20th, 1903, a toy company gets a check for $98.20 from Robert Cole Sr. On September 6, 1909, a private boys' school gets a check for $2,250 from Robert Cole Sr. September 6, 1915, an exclusive military academy gets a check for $3,150 from Robert Cole Sr. October 1st, 1921, a Cadillac dealer gets a check for $3,700 from Robert Cole Sr. November 7th, 1921, an auto repair shop gets a check for $300.75 from Robert Cole Sr. First, what was the main thing that happened here? A baby was born. Was it a boy or a girl? It was a boy. And what was the boy's name? Robert Cole Jr. Now, I didn't get that right the first time. I'm a very good reader. Why didn't I get it right? Schema is influenced by our culture. I was brought up in a Jewish part of Brooklyn. In the Jewish culture, you never name a son Junior. It's not customary. We usually name our children after a relative who's deceased. My son's name is Alex. My grandfather, who I had a very close relationship with, was also named Alex. After he died, I passed along his name to my son. I wasn't even considering the possibility of Howard Jr. because it isn't done in my culture. So I overlooked the possibility that Robert Cole Sr. was the father who changed his name to Sr. when he named his son Jr. because that's not something I do. So I omitted it from my math, and I missed some very important information. Culture is an important part of reading and information. And later in the program, I will discuss how to be more culturally sensitive to some of the things that we read. In fact, I think many of the problems in our world are schematically related. They're cultural. Cultures that historically have been isolated for centuries because of the slowness of communication and travel are now rubbing elbows. And because everyone's beliefs and values are different and they're rubbing against each other, there's friction. By learning to communicate and understanding other people's beliefs and values, we can look forward to a successful world. We fail to do that, there may not be a world. And it starts with reading. For example, if I'm reading a book written by a cannibal on recipes, it doesn't mean I'm going to run out and try the recipes. However, what I did find in anthropology that many cannibalistic cultures, what they did is they took a little piece of brain from a dead relative. They thought the soul was in the brain. And they basically saying, Grandpa, you're dead, but you can stay in me now. Or Grandma, you're dead, you can stay in me now. Now, I kind of drew a line in the sand. I gave my son my grandfather's name. I'm not trying any grandpa brain recipes. It's repulsive to me. It's not part of my values. But I can understand that this person's intention was similar to my own. They wanted to keep that person close to them, and they did it a different way. And so while I may not want to go to lunch with that person or be lunch for that person, they become more human because of my ability to look at them and understand what they're trying to do. But it doesn't change who I am or what I believe in. And as we read more and more from around the world where people have different ways of looking and seeing things, in order to even begin to communicate, we need this. Picture two people sitting on two sides of a table. The number that's laying on the table from one side looks like the number 6. From the opposite side, it looks like the number 9. Well, you actually need to be in the third position, standing away from the table, to see that both people are right and both people are wrong. And that's what this is about. It's gaining perspective, looking at things through one person's perspective, another person's map, your own, and then looking at a third position where you can see how both of them have elements of truth and elements of non-truth. And then you get to the solution of problems. That's what good readers need to do. Now, Robert Cole Sr., is he rich, is he poor, is he middle class? Well, many people would say, he looks pretty rich to me. What if I looked at the toy on December 20th and said 98.20? What a cheap toy. The wrapping paper at FAO Schwartz is more than $98. The sales tax on some of these games you get for your kids today is more than $98. What would you say to me? Well, if you look at the date, 1903, you'd say, gee, back in 1903, $98 was a lot of money. And I'd say, that's right. Inferentially, use your map and knew that money was worth more back then. But what if you didn't know? How could you use the information on this page and use it as a relative measuring stick to get the value of the $98? Well, look at the hospital, $125. That's almost as much as the toy. Can you imagine someone giving you a present that costs as much as the hospital charged to deliver a baby? That's what you're seeing here. Yet in Canada, where I frequently do workshops, they almost never pick the hospital. They pick the Cadillac for $3,700. Obviously, that's another giveaway. That's about the cost of an oil change today. Why don't they pick the hospital? Because in Canada, medical care is free. And in their map, $125 is a lot of money for something that should be free. So it's not their religion that created a different map. It's their country's medical policy. So again, we see how schema can change how we convert information from data. It alters the way we perceive it. What do we know about Robert Cole Sr.? Is he a good father or not so good? And if he's good, why is he good? Well, in my live programs, people will often say he's a good father because he sent his son to the best schools. Actually, this is a trick question. I'll pretend I'm an attorney, first for the father and then the mother in a custody battle. You're the jury. Here's the evidence. He's a great father. This is the father's attorney. He spent a fortune on baby furnishings. He sent him to the best hospital and to a doctor when most people were using midwives. He bought him lavish toys and sent him to the best schools for discipline and breeding so he could give him the company he had built over his lifetime when the boy got older. On his 18th birthday, he bought him a Cadillac. Notice, the hospital was paid on the 1st. The doctor was paid 1 month to the day later, 11-1, and 18 years to the day later, the Cadillac was bought. That was his birthday present. And 4 days later, or 6 days later in this case, after he totaled the car, his father fixed it because he was a great dad. That was the first attorney. Great dad, he should get the kid. Now the mother's attorney. He's a bum. He spent a lot of money because he was a wealthy man. Didn't want to look cheap to his friends and family. He bought his son one present in 18 years and then sent him away from home. He didn't know it was his son's birthday when he bought himself a new car. So he was a very selfish man. Which attorney told the truth? Neither. It's not their job to tell the truth. See, we have an inferential legal system where a judge or a jury infer inferentially whose presentation of the facts made the most sense, what was more believable. It's better than the old system. Remember King Henry VIII? If he didn't like you, it wasn't very good to be married to him. So the English came up with a better system, the jury system. You get to tell a dozen people why you should be exonerated, and after they hear all the evidence, they decide whose explanation was the most realistic and truthful. It's not a perfect system, but it's better than the one it replaced. Here's something inferential that's often overlooked, the auto repair. Did you presume the car had an accident and had to be fixed? Is it possible Robert Cole Sr. had more than one car and he fixed his other car? Could that have happened? Or perhaps Robert's friend owned an auto repair shop and he said, you know, if you have your car detailed and decked out by me after you buy it, I'll save you a lot of money and I'll be able to make the car look really snazzy. Could that have happened? See, that's the difference between reading and good reading. Reading is looking at what's there and taking it for granted. Good reading is questioning, challenging, looking for meaning, and looking for proof, for validation, so that when someone tells you something's true, they don't just say it, they show you why it's true. You don't have to jump to conclusions and believe everything that you see. So this is a very good exercise for learning how schema can make text meaningful. What we're going to do now is use the schematic clues to read backwards to begin to get some comprehension. And the first drills we did, I'm sure you found it very difficult to comprehend while reading backwards. Our next exercise should solve that problem. Here we see schematic clues in backwards reading. I've bolded the schema, the words that are most important and most meaningful. You're going to read one line at a time back and forth, looking only for bolded words. If a word is not bolded, move your hand more rapidly till you find the next word that is. And as you go back and forth and down this page, I want you to look for the who, the what, the where, the when, the why, and the how. When you've completed this exercise, return to the audio portion of this program. Ready? Begin. Well, what was this about? The American War for Independence. Were any of the names more familiar than any of the others? Chances are Paul Revere stood out because I talked about him specifically a while back. And what did we learn? Where was Paul standing? Near the bay. What did he taste? The salt. What did he see? Two shiny lanterns. What happened next? He got on his horse. And what did he feel? The saddle. And what did he hear? The hooves on the cobblestones. And then what? The hooves on the forest. And what did he smell? The piney scent of the trees. And in the distance, what did he see? The home of a Minuteman. Now, we haven't covered this for a while. And notice the details that flowed back as we went back over the information. How often have you found, right after learning something, you didn't remember what it was? When I asked you this, you didn't know I was going to drill you on what I taught you a little while ago. And look at how well you were able to retain most of the details. Imagine and picture in the future doing this consciously and deliberately when you're learning, using more of the senses, when you actually know you want to remember and retain something. And now, how much more powerful will it become lodged into your memory using this simple strategy? We've just seen just how powerful it is. Now that we've learned about schema and we've seen how schema makes text meaningful, we're ready to learn how to perform a second speed increasing exercise. Let me explain how this exercise works, and then you're going to go to your audio material containing drill number 2. You're going to put a paperclip on the first page in which you're reading, first page of chapter 1. You're going to read at your comprehension rate for 1 minute using your hand. Then you go back to the paperclip and double your speed for 1 minute. Then you go back to the paperclip and triple your speed for 1 minute. Now, here's where it changes. In the fourth minute, continue where you just finished at the end of the third minute. Continue to read for 1 minute at your comprehension rate. And when you're done, you move the paperclip to the new position. So is that clear? We read for a minute, we go back, we double, we go back, we triple, we don't go back. We stay where we were at the end of the third minute, and we continue in the fourth minute reading at our peak comprehension rate. And when we're done, we move the paperclip, and the next drill starts where the paperclip is located. When you complete exercise 2, go back to the audio training materials in your program. Well, congratulations, you've just completed the second phase of the program. We now learned how schema helps us to understand and comprehend text more effectively. Now we're ready to combine the two skills, using our hand motions and schema to reach even higher reading speeds with better comprehension. Let's see how textual schema is distributed in text. It's not even. The opening and closing chapters of a book are a map of what it will cover or a summary of what it did cover. They contain a great deal of schema. When I'm actually reading, I read those sections a little slower to get a map of where I'm going or where I've just been. Similarly, the opening and closing paragraphs of a chapter are a map of what it will cover or a summary of what it did cover. There's more schema. So in each chapter, I read the opening and closing paragraph a little more attentively to know where I'm going or where I've been. What helps us to increase throughout text is the topic sentence. Topic sentence is a map of the paragraph, telling you where it was going or where it's been. Most frequently, it's the first sentence, telling us where it's going. The second most common position for a topic sentence is the last sentence, where it tells us where we've been. For our purposes, we'll presume the first sentence is a topic sentence. What we're going to do is a simple exercise in your familiar book. Before, in the first minute, we read at a comprehension rate. In the second minute, we stay double the whole time. In the third minute, we stay triple the whole time. That changes. What we're going to do now is we're going to read in the first sentence at our comprehension rate for the first minute. Then, we're going to look at the first sentence in a paragraph. We're going to read that to pick up the map of the paragraph. So we read it a little slower. And to make up for the slowing down, to keep our average doubled or tripled, we go even more rapidly, looking for the verbs and nouns that answer the questions of who, what, where, when, why, and how. So now, each of the doubled and tripled minutes, we're still averaging doubled and tripled speed, but we're not staying at the same rate. We slow down where there's more schema and speed up where there's less. Similar to the exercise we did earlier about the American Revolution, where there was bolded text. You more rapidly moved your hand between words that weren't bolded, that didn't have schematic clues, and focused more intently where there were schematic clues. Well, unfortunately, most books aren't going to bold the schema for you. So we have to use the other strategy we learned about earlier, having a purpose. The brain makes things that we look for bigger, brighter, bolder, more meaningful. The topic sentence tells us what we're looking for. And then we search at a higher speed for more of the who, what, where, when, why, and how details. Go to the first page of chapter 1 in your familiar book. And for 1 minute, I want you to read at your comprehension rate. Ready? Begin. Stop. Go back, and I want you to read now at a doubled rate. Read the first sentence of each paragraph, and then go rapidly looking for the who, what, where, when, why, and how, so your average stays doubled. Ready? Begin. stop. Terrific. Now we're ready for the third minute. Going to read for 1 minute at a tripled rate, going back to the first page, first chapter. Look at the first sentence to get the schema, and then go triple speed looking for the who, what, where, when, why, and how. Ready? Begin. Stop. That's great. Now, we're ready for the last step to increase speed using schema. There's two possibilities. You're either reading in a familiar subject where you already have a map, or in an unfamiliar subject where you don't have a map and you have to build one. When we read in a familiar subject, we should be able to gain a lot of speed. Earlier, I mentioned how comprehension problems often occur because writers presume we knew things that we didn't. Actually, it's often more often the opposite case. They presume that we don't know things that we know because we've read other books on the subject. We've done things. We've had life experiences. But as a writer, I'm writing for an audience, for a group. I don't know every individual in that group. And I have to presume there'll be people in that group who have no experience in the subject and provide all of the necessary background that everyone might need to learn the book. The fact that much of what I'm providing you already know means that you could speed up dramatically. When you find something you know already, something familiar, like the Mona Lisa was earlier, immediately switch to your triple speed. Watch the topic sentences, verbs, and nouns. If in fact it is familiar, like the Mona Lisa, the pattern will contain the meaning. You'll know what you're reading. If it's not, then you shouldn't be doing this. We only do this when it is familiar. Ironically, most people do the opposite. You actually slow down when something's familiar. For familiarity creates comfort, and we like to be comfortable. Picture yourself reading a confusing chemistry book. Suddenly you find a chapter that's interesting and familiar. Are you in a hurry to finish and get back to the more challenging sections of the book? Or might you spend a little more time being comfortable than you should? That's a bad learning strategy. When you find something familiar, immediately triple your speed, watch the topic sentence, verbs, and nouns. If it's familiar, the pattern will make it meaningful. If it's not, slow down to a comprehension rate. This is also an excellent strategy for reading newspapers or even magazine articles. We often read the news after hearing it on the radio or seeing it on television. So the information that you already know from this other source is familiar to you. Speed through it to find the new relevant information that you decide you want to know and put more time there. Now, the other situation is we're reading in an unfamiliar subject. In an unfamiliar subject, we could still speed up most of the time because even a textbook is only about 40% information and 60% explanation. There are stories, anecdotes, examples, illustrations telling you things you need to do or know to make the information more useful. And you know you might need that information if it's a technical book and you don't get it. Seeing someone using it, doing it, applying it. For example, you're reading an accounting book talking about a tax law and you actually see someone incorporating that into a return. Now it makes it easier to understand. But what if you get it? What if it makes sense to you? What if you understand it? And you don't need the extra help. Why should you read help that was put there for someone else when you don't need it? Let me give an example. One of the most successful books ever published was The Power of Positive Thinking. And the structure of that book is still widely emulated in many of the self-help books that are being written. There's a paragraph about a problem. There's a paragraph on how to solve the problem. And then there's a 28-page story about someone who had the problem and solved it using the strategy. So the bulk of the chapter is the story rather than the solution and the problem. Well, if you understand what to do and how to do it and why to do it and when to do it, do you really need to see someone else doing it? You could finish the book in 10 minutes, identify 20 problems, 20 solutions, and start using them instead of reading a lot of little stories. On the other hand, if you're not sure what to do or how it's done, seeing someone using it could be a big help. Now, there is a mind map summarizing how schema's distribution can be useful in learning. You might want to look at it. And then we're going to continue with our last speed increasing exercise. Speed increasing exercise 3 is similar to the last two drills. You read for a minute at your peak comprehension rate. Then, instead of going back like we did before, we continue at the end of each minute, at the end of each and every minute where we just finished. So we don't go back anymore. We start on page 1 of chapter 1. We read for a minute at comprehension rate. Then we double from wherever we finished. Then we triple from wherever we finished. And then we read for 1 minute at our peak comprehension rate. And we continue the next drill where we just finished. So the big difference here is at the end of each and every minute, we start the next drill, the next minute where we just finished. So let's go to exercise 3, and when you're done, come back and continue with the learning material and the audio portion of your program. Well, now that you've completed the third drill designed to increase your reading speed, we're ready to see just how fast and rapidly you can read. So let's go back to the section in text that was designed to measure your reading speed that we used earlier, and we're going to once again do an exercise to measure your current reading speed. If you encounter something that you already know that's familiar to you, triple your speed. If you find an idea or a concept that makes sense and it's explained and you don't need the explanation, triple your speed. How fast can we read by combining our use of schematic clues with our ability to use our hand to move a line more rapidly? Remember to use your hand. Triple your speed if it's either familiar or unnecessary text. You're at the top of the page, line 1, ready, begin. Stop. Now look at the number on the line you just finished and multiply that number by 10. And this is your ending reading speed, and compare it with your initial speed. To put it into perspective, less than 5% of people in North America read over 400 words a minute. That's something I heard at one of my workshops. There's a very good chance you're already reading at that speed or greater. A lot of people will say, well, Howard, we already read this. Of course we're reading faster. I did this on purpose. Think about what most people tend to read. They read books on subjects they're interested in and want to learn more about. Now, I have all these different people taking this program with different experiences and at different ages. I wanted to create a situation where some of the text was familiar and known already, as it is in many of the books you read, and some of it was novel or new. So you're actually seeing a piece of text that represents what you typically experience when you read. Some of the stuff you're reading you already know, and some of it is new. So it actually does represent very nicely what most people experience in their day-to-day reading. Now I'd recommend taking a 5-minute break, and when you're done, I'm going to show you how to actually learn when you read. What we've covered up to now is how to speed up, how to overcome slow reading habits and increase the rate which our brain perceives information. Your speed is higher, your comprehension is okay, and your attention is not anywhere near what it needs to be. In the next part of our program, we're going to address all of this. We're going to learn how to understand better, comprehend better, and improve our retention of information. We're actually going to begin learning now how to read to understand. So after you're done with your break, come back to the learning portion of your program and we'll continue. Okay, now we're ready to learn the four reading stages, which are often called SR2Q, which stands for skimming, reading, reviewing, and questioning. Skimming is the 50,000-foot view. It's getting the lay of the land. For example, if you ever read a book, got to the end, and there was a great appendix, only you didn't know it was there till when? Till you got to the end, and you didn't need it anymore. Would it have helped if you knew it was there when you actually needed it? And skimming lets you know that it's coming before you actually get to it. Or how about this? You're in a book and you're finding the information a little confusing. And then you find there was a picture or a chart or a diagram just another page away that eliminated the problem. But when would you find out? When you turn the page. It's too late. So you end up wasting a lot of valuable time. So skimming actually lets you know where you're going before you get to it. And I'll show you specifically what to do during skimming in a moment. Then you read. You read at your peak comprehension rate. And you hold a pencil in your hand. If you find something that you don't understand or isn't making sense, you need to think about, put a little line in the margin next to it. Don't highlight. Highlighting requires you to uncap the marker, then paint the words with pinpoint accuracy, which is very laborious and time-consuming. Putting a mark in the margin does the same thing. It says, come back and look at this again. You need to think about this. You need to analyze it. When you find something you actually want to learn, put a star in the margin. That tells you this is something to memorize or retain. And I always put a lot of lines and stars when I'm reading. And I can always change a line to a star by drawing an X through it. If you could picture a line with an X drawn through it, it becomes a star. So while I'm reading, I'm busy marking off the text that I'm going to go back to and use a study skill to learn and a memory skill to lock in. And then we use questioning to get the brain analyzing and thinking while we read. And all of this will now be covered in the next part of the Maximum Speed Reading Program. First, let's learn how to skim text. One of the first things we see when we buy a book is the title on the binder. And often the title, while it might interest and attract us to the book, may not accurately describe what the book actually accomplishes. That's why we skim the book's jacket. The book's jacket often describes the features and benefits and summarizes the contents of the book. So it's very valuable information, and it only takes a few seconds to skim. We actually skim at 2 to 5 seconds per page. This actually even helped me years ago on a show that I was on. About 8 or 9 years ago, I was on a show with Dennis Leary on Comedy Central, and he was interviewing me and Jackie Collins. She had just written the book Lady Boss. They wanted me to read this 700-page book in about 5 minutes. And before I actually read the book, the cameraman came up to me and he said, do me a favor, just rub the jacket cover for a few minutes so I could see where your hands will be when you're actually reading and get a better shot. Well, the hardcovered book had a jacket that listed many of the main characters' names, like Mike, Moe, Murray, and Mel. Now, at 80, 90 pages a minute, they look like some guy whose name starts with the letter M. Very hard to distinguish the names visually. But by making a picture of what they look like, one guy was really nasty, a criminal. So he looked like Tony Soprano in my imagination. Another guy was really good looking. And so each character had an icon or a facial expression that went along with the name. Then when I actually read the book, instead of hearing the name, I saw the picture. Like you might do when reading the paper, and you read about President Bush or President Clinton. You don't hear a name, you actually see an individual. By making the text become more visual, using the cover and the information that it had on the jacket, I was able to read the novel successfully in just a few short minutes and then take a quiz on the contents. When you write a book, you don't write a book and then sell it. You sell a book and then write it. And one of the key elements in selling the book is the contents page. I have a sample of a contents page on the next page in your book. The contents page is carefully reviewed by a publisher for organization to see how the book will work and whether the author actually understands the subject well enough to write a successful book. I would like you to skim in 2 seconds these pages for the history lesson. We're going to begin on the next page. I'm going to count 1,000 to 1,000 twice, and when I'm done, you're finished skimming this history lesson contents page. Ready? Begin. 1,000 to 1,000. Next page. 1,000 to 1,000. Stop. Okay, well, what subject is this? Well, I think we pretty much decided it was history. What kind of history? American history. What period in American history? Early American history. Well, if you were doing a report on the importance of Monica Lewinsky in the Clinton administration, would this be the best book to select? No. How do you know that? Because it's a book on early American history, and that's modern American history. And how long did it take to find that out? 6 seconds? 4 seconds? Almost no time at all, compared to the weeks that often go by before we realize we have the wrong book. So skimming gives us the 50,000-foot view. It tells us where we're going and what's covered. In addition to matching the contents page to my goals and purposes, I also would ask myself, have I ever studied this subject before? If I have, how challenging was it? Or how boring, or how interesting was it? Based on my prior experience with similar books on similar subjects, I can guesstimate how long this book might take to learn before I run into a problem and not have enough time to study it. Let's continue. On the next page, we see another contents page. This one from a vertebrate biology book, Part 5, Comparative Vertebrate Zoology. Chapter 11, Fish, Physiology, Mating, and Eating. Chapter 12, Amphibians, Physiology, Mating, and Eating. Chapter 13, Reptiles, what would you expect to come next? Physiology, Mating, and Eating. What you found was the organizational pattern of the writer. Very important information. See, when people begin reading quickly for the first time, it's normal to experience concern about possibly missing something important. But if you know what's coming before you get to it, you won't miss it. You know the next thing covered in this book is reptile physiology, and you expect it. What did we learn earlier about the brain when it's looking for something and expects it, and it's there? You find it. And so it's very important to skim the contents page to get a sense of where you're going, as well as each chapter in the book, so that you have a very fresh map of what you're about to traverse and you understand what's coming before you get to it. When you're anticipating what's coming next, you can go quicker and quicker with less and less concern about missing, because when you expect it and it's there, you find it. Now, let's learn how to learn what I call the hard stuff, difficult material. I've chosen biochemistry because it's hard. Most people find it confusing. I wanted something representative of something very technical and challenging. So I chose the glycolysis cycle, which is how energy is generated in many cells. But that's not really what we're here to learn. We're here to learn how to learn hard stuff. First of all, you want the big picture. The mistake most people make is they try to memorize details when they don't even know what the pattern is. First, we want to get the structure or the pattern. I cover this more in my advanced program because part of writing is organizing things into patterns. Part of reading is recognizing the patterns that were used by the writer to create the organization. One pattern is big, bigger, biggest. Cell, tissue, organ. Planet, solar system, galaxy. That's big, bigger, biggest, used in science quite often. Then there's past, present, future, often seen in history, biography, even in novels. And then there's ordinal, first, second, third. In this case, we have step one, glucose-6-phosphate. Step 2, fructose-6-phosphate. You don't have to know what it means. You don't have to understand it. All you have to know is what's step 1, what's step 2, what's step 3, what's step 4. Once you've got the pattern, then you can learn the details. What happens? Where does it happen? When does it happen? How does it happen? Why does it happen? But when you don't have a pattern, your brain doesn't know where to link the details. And they're quickly forgotten as the brain just sees lots of words on a page that quickly disappear. It also helps to draw pictures that are representative of the ideas you're trying to learn. And then to hang those pictures in a familiar part of the house. If I was to ask you to describe the furniture in each room of your house, one wall at a time, you might be able to spend hours, if not days, without studying, because that's your territory, and your brain is very familiar with its territory. Well, these colorful pictures with the main ideas linked on spokes from the center, like a wheel might have a spoke, and when you're looking at each of these lines with the main idea in color, your brain sees it as a painting. And you quickly get the main structure of what you're trying to learn, which will make it easier when you get to the memory techniques later to link the details to the main concept. It makes learning difficult material much simpler. So the trick here is to get the 50,000 foot view, see the main details, get the pattern, and then focus upon linking the details. Now, let's learn how to use an index to increase our understanding of a book. Most people use an index to locate the specific page a topic is located on, and that's a very good use of an index. But here's one you may not have thought of. At triple speed or greater, you can't learn new, technical, unfamiliar vocabulary. What you can do is recognize words you know already. An analogy to this is walking through the mall around Christmas time. As you stroll through the mall, you see many, many faces that you don't know. And your brain doesn't say, don't know them, don't know them. Look, there's my brother or sister. The brain alerts you when you meet someone who's familiar. But to recognize that familiar face, you have to look at all the unfamiliar faces first. It just doesn't occur on a conscious level. Well, the same thing happens in an index. The words that are familiar to you, that you already know, that you don't have to learn, you'll quickly spot and recognize, even at high speed. The harder it is to spot words that have meaning and are familiar, the more new and unfamiliar words there are in the book, and the more time that book will probably take to learn. Let's test ourselves on this as we skim the first indice, which comes from a first-year psychology program. And notice what we're seeing. Perception, five phenomena, place learning, play, population, probability. Compare that with a first-semester biology book index found 2 pages later. And we see words like cardiac glycoside and cellular defecation and centrioles. These words are not as familiar and are more difficult. Before you can learn what a centriole is, you have to learn how to pronounce it and how to spell it. So you actually have to learn the word. Whereas a word like play, even though the reference in the book may not be one you're expecting, you already know the word. And you're able to make an association to it much quicker. So if you were studying in both of these books, which book do you think will take longer and be more challenging? The biology book. And how long did that take to find out? About 7 or 8 seconds. Here's the way to do this. At the beginning of a semester in school, quickly skim each book, including the indice. And when you skim that indice, you're going to quickly determine how difficult it is to recognize what's in the book. And then you're going to quickly read at the beginning of each semester in the most challenging subjects first. You know how at the beginning of the school semester there's usually very little work and a lot of free time and everyone parties, particularly in college. That's when you get a jump on your work. You jump far ahead, speed reading all of those texts, so by the time there's tests and exams and projects, you're so far ahead of your reading assignment that there's no pressure to keep up. If you're at work, it's the same strategy. As soon as a project is assigned, speed read to get ahead. Don't tell them you read 10 times faster. They'll give you 10 times more work and won't pay you for it. Just amaze everyone with how you finish on time and ahead of everyone else. In a time when there's very little job security, being the guy or gal who consistently gets the job done on time and has the information available that's needed gives you a little bit more security. So this indice reading, the skimming of the indexes, gives you a very, very interesting insight into which of your texts will be more challenging and need more time, so you can make time for it at the beginning before you unfortunately run out of time. See, many books begin by reviewing what you already know. For example, organic chemistry reviews inorganic chemistry. Calculus reviews algebra. Although those subjects are difficult, if you pass them and moved on to the next step, it's a review. And usually you don't get to the new material till around chapter 10 or 11. So you get a false sense of security that this is very familiar material. And then you might procrastinate thinking the book is easier than it actually is. And many people find what happens by the time they realize the book is going to be harder than they expected, they don't have the time to catch up. Skimming that index tells you right away everything that's coming before you reach it. And then you can anticipate how much time each book will take and not run into that dilemma ever again. Now we're going to learn a number of strategies from one single page. First, you see a map that shows you what pages certain articles are on. In many cases, you don't have enough time to read an entire magazine. Finding out what articles are there before you read it so you could prioritize and focus upon the articles that have the most important priority to you and your interest is a smart move. But here's something that might help. I've heard that the average person spends 2 to 3 years of their life waiting on a line. Maybe not all at once, unless you go to the bank or the post office, but 2 to 3 years of your life waiting on a line, waiting for a waitress, a waiter, getting served at a cash register at a store. Those lines are there, and they're not going away. And most of us are frustrated waiting on lines because we can't get important things done. Here's a wake-up call. 2 to 3 years of your life waiting on a line with nothing to do and not enough time to get your reading done. How about taking your books and some of your study material to the post office, to the bank, or when you go shopping? And next time you're waiting on a line, start speed reading the materials you never had time to learn before. You'll find you have an extra 2 to 3 years to read that you never had in the past. Not only will you find the time to read things you didn't have time for before, you'll stop dreading the lines that are going to come anyway and see them as opportunities for catching up. Now on this page, we see a story that has a secondary story. And we're going to learn a strategy for how to deal with embedded stories. You know, you're reading a story and suddenly you realize there's a second story right there. What do? Stop and start the second story? Or read the first one and come back? What's a good strategy for handling embedded stories? First, you skim the primary to see if you even want to read. The primary story here is about a problem in Somalia. And as you're reading it, you might say, I don't care. Or you might say, I do care. If you don't care, even though you realize it's another story, why would you read it? You're not interested in the main story. On the other hand, if you do care, and perhaps you might, you now know there's another story that needs to be read. Before reading the primary story on top, I would then skim the secondary story to find out what that's about. It's explaining why there is a problem. And if I don't know why, I would read it first. If I know why, because I heard it on the news, or saw it on television, or read it someplace else, I wouldn't need to read it again. This would be redundant. So the strategy is simple. Skim the whole story. Do I want to read this? Now I'm aware I want to read it, and there's a secondary story. skim the secondary? Do I know this yet? If the answer is no, read it first and then read the primary. Once you have a better understanding of the news taking place in Somalia, you knew why it was taking place, what caused the problem. And that's what the secondary story is, schema or background. The same thing's true to a large sense about footnotes. It often makes me laugh to watch students reading Shakespearean plays. You know how they have that English to English dictionary on the bottom of each page? And when do you get to the bottom of the page? After you read the whole page in Old English and haven't got a clue what you just read. And your brain's saying, oh my God, there's 900 more pages and I have to actually read them. Somebody shoot me. I think we've all been in that situation from one point in our lives or another. Here's a better way of handling that. What if you read the English to English dictionary footnotes first so you actually knew what the words meant on the page when you saw them? Isn't there a lower probability of getting frustrated in a book if you actually understood what the words meant? So most of us don't read those words till after we're frustrated and confused. My strategy is read them first so the frustration never happens. And so footnotes are very important and get read first because they give us context and insight that make the main text easier to understand. Now, for those of you who take tests, here's a good way to take tests more effectively. Take a pencil into your exam and at triple speed or greater, read the questions. Just like an index, at that speed, something you don't already know will not be familiar to you. So anything that's making any sense probably had a clue that made sense to you, meaning you probably could answer that question. Since on some tests we don't have enough time to finish, by locating which questions we have some understanding for, we have a better chance of getting the maximum credit possible by marking them off and doing those questions first. Another strategy is to read the essays before beginning the test. Most people get to the essays at the end. They usually have 10 minutes to write 5 essays. Not a lot of time. It's difficult to create a test on a subject matter area and not provide some insights to the answers the essays are seeking elsewhere. For example, if it's a test on the circulatory system and they ask you for the names of the different blood vessels, and you know it's coming, and now you're taking the test knowing that's an essay, and you get a multiple choice question. Which of the following blood vessels pumps blood away from the heart? The artery, the arterial, the capillary, the venule, or the vein? You just got the 5 parts of the circulatory system. The essay's going to want later. You mark it off, and you're able to use it. The way most people go, they get to the essay, they have very little time left. Even if they saw the information, they haven't got time now to go look for it again. They don't have extra time. Knowing ahead of time what's coming later, you'll be able to anticipate your needs, and when you're taking the rest of the test and spot something that has potential later on the essays, you can make better use of it. And that should help many of you get better grades on tests. Same strategy holds true for standardized tests like SATs and GREs, GMEDs, and LSATs. When you can, and it's not always possible, but when you can, read the questions first. Most people read these enormous reading selections, then they read the questions. They don't know the answers because they don't know what to look for. They have to read the reading passage again. A double waste of time. Doesn't it make more sense to read the questions first? Then you know what you're looking for when you're reading the first time and find it. It cuts the reading in half, giving you more time to complete a lengthy test and upping your grade. And that's exactly the strategy that you want. Incidentally, a similar strategy should be used when learning a subject on your own that's technical when you're doing it outside of school where no one can be counted on to help you. Buy books that have summaries and questions. One of the biggest challenges in a new technical subject is, what should I learn? Well, my guess is, if you don't know anything about a subject and someone wrote a book on it, there's a high probability they know more about that subject than you do. And if they have a summary, it's telling you what they thought you should learn. The problem with summaries is it comes at the end. by the time you get to the end, you've missed everything you should have learned. Since you're skimming and you bought a book that has summaries, you're going to read the summaries first. Find out what you're supposed to look for, and then when you're reading, know what to prioritize so you don't miss it. The brain will be looking for that information. You also want to read the questions. If you're not sure which literal information to memorize, the questions are what the writer prioritized. It's a very good starting place. By reading those questions first and then reading the chapter, you know what you want to find before you miss it. And you get the answers that are asked for at the end while reading. It increases your understanding. Now, the better you get at a subject, the more experience you gain in a subject, the less you'll have to depend upon the strategy. But this is an excellent strategy for learning technical subjects on your own for the first time. You might also consider going online and raising questions in special interest groups. The problem with special interest groups is they're not always as smart as they make themselves out to be. Anyone can misrepresent themselves online. Online, my name is Sven. I'm 20 years old, and I'm blonde, and I'm 6'8". And so if you want to believe that, if you see me on television, you know what kind of truth you might get in a special interest group, which is why I pay very close attention to the other members' criticisms of the responses I'm getting. If someone gives me something, and a lot of people then say, I don't agree with this, there's a good chance they don't know what they're talking about. On the other hand, if someone offers me advice and many other people say that's great advice, there's a higher likelihood that it is great advice. Since I don't know, I'm relying more on the judgment of other experts. And I'll cover more of this in my advanced program when I teach you how to do research for writing. Another important thing to consider is questioning. You must ask literal, implied, and inferential questions while reading to give your brain purpose and focus and motivation. Years ago, I was teaching a class on the 5 causes of disease. I put all the answers on the board, and I asked the students after completing the lesson to name one of the 5 causes. After 20 minutes, someone noticed the board and said bacteria. I said, great, terrific answer. What's a bacteria? And they looked at me and said with a very serious face, one of the 5 causes of disease. Unfortunately, that's how many students are learning in our schools. They don't really understand the answers as much as they learn how to take tests and put answers on a page. As proof of that, most adults who had high school geometry, by the time they're 25, all they remember is length times width equal area, so they could put a rug in their living room, or lay a linoleum. That took them a year to learn. We spent 4 years of our life learning math, and look where it got us, because we never really understood what it meant when we learned it in the first place. That's where the questions come in. A good student would say, what are bacteria? Are they all bad? No, some are good. How are good ones helpful? How are bad ones harmful? Are they similar or different? How are they similar or different? If I get infected, how can I cure myself? What could I do to prevent an infection? These types of questions make the brain curious. A brain that's inquisitive and curious and seeking meaning, seeking information, is a brain that's ready to learn. A brain that's watching the clock and saying, good, my favorite TV show comes in 10 minutes, is a brain that wants to watch their favorite television show in 10 minutes and is not paying attention to the text and will not learn. So your questions and your state of mind are critical for learning. Now on the next page, I have a mind map summarizing some of the things we just discussed about skimming. Be aware that doing these same activities at a slower rate than the 2 to 5 seconds per page is recommended for skimming is excellent for study skills and analysis of things that are confusing to you. Some of the questions I might ask is, what does this mean? How can I use this? What should I do next? One of the best questions you could always ask is, what's the next best thing I can do now? Those types of questions gives your brain a reason to learn and to look for meaning, and so understanding takes place, rather than simply looking at a lot of words on a page that make no sense. If all it took was reading, then every student who read a book would get an A. If all it took was memory, then every student who memorized the math formulas in their math book would get an A. Meaning is very, very important, and it's questions and analysis that lead to a state of understanding. And I will give you a study strategy at the end of this program that's proven very successful for a number of students. Next, I'd like to talk to you about emotional intelligence. The latest study suggests that your EQ, or your emotional intelligence, is a far better predictor of your life success than your IQ. The problem with emotional intelligence is that although we know what good emotional intelligence is, we aren't often told how to get it. A good example, when you're having a nervous breakdown, having someone say relax really isn't that helpful. If it was that simple, there wouldn't be any Prozac. How many times have good students had anxiety attacks during tests? How many times have intelligent and articulate professionals fallen apart trying to deliver a presentation in front of a live audience only to find that the butterflies in their stomach made it so difficult for them to remember their name they couldn't remember anything else they wanted to say as well? How many of you have experienced exhaustion and fatigue while trying to accomplish a laborious mental chore? By learning to develop emotional intelligence, we can change that. I'm going to give you an exercise in this program for boosting your energy. In the advanced program, I'll describe some other strategies that solve other EQ dilemmas. First, I'd like you to stand up. I'd like you to begin marching in place, left, right, left, right, left, right. Excellent. Excellent. Now, take your left hand and I want you to touch your left hand to your right thigh, and then your right hand to your left thigh. Alternate, left, right. Arms swinging, left, right. Opposite leg, opposite leg. Now put your hand, your right hand, up in the air. Squeeze your right hand tightly and say, I feel energized. Say it like you mean it. I feel energized. And pull your hand down to your right side and say, yes, I do. Okay, we're going to do 3 sets of these, and then I'm going to show you how this can boost your energy. Begin marching in place. Left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right. Touch your left hand to your right thigh. Your right to your left. Your right to your left. Your right to your left. Left to your right. Alternately. Alternately. Hand over your head and say it like you need it. I feel energized. Squeeze your thumb. Pull it to your right side. Yes, I do. Let's do one more set. Marching in place, marching in place, left, right, left, right. Begin touching your opposite thigh with your hand. Left to right, right to left, left to right, right to left, left to right, right to left. Hand over your head and say it like you need it. I feel energized. Squeeze your thumb. Yes, I do, as you pull it down. Now, what did you learn? Remember Pavlov? He rang a bell, he fed a dog. He rang a bell, he fed a dog. He rang a bell, the dog drooled. You don't want to drool. You do want more energy. Studies have suggested that using one side of your brain and then the other gives it sort of a brain massage. So we know one side of the brain controls the left side of the body, the right controls the left controls the right. By marching in place, we're alternately using one side and the other side of the brain. Then we took our hand and touched the opposite thigh. Both sides of our brain had to move at the same time. And then, because we were moving after sitting for so many hours, our blood started to flow. We got more oxygen to our brain. Our heart beat a little bit quicker. And at the peak of this extra energy burst, we squeezed our right hand and said, I feel energized. Yes, I do. And pulled your hand down to the right. That becomes the bell. What we're going to do is repeat this drill many times over the next few weeks, several times a day. Not once or twice, but dozens of times. What do you think will happen when you're in the middle of a long meeting or a long exam, and after doing this for several weeks, several times a day, you squeeze your right thumb tightly, pull it to your side, and say to yourself, I feel energized. This becomes the conditioned stimulus, the bell, and you respond with the state you were in. Now, studies have suggested that learning is state dependent. One of my students at a workshop told me of a study done in Russia. They got a bunch of men together and they had them drink a lot of vodka. It wasn't hard to get volunteers, apparently, for this experiment. They had to learn vocabulary words, nonsense syllables, while inebriated. And while inebriated, they were able to remember a lot of words. But when they got sober, they couldn't remember what they learned. What was interesting is when they got inebriated again, they could remember the words once more. The state they were in was the state they needed to be in when they use the information. Now, if we study in a relaxed atmosphere at home and we take it into a traumatic work area or a school area, take, for example, a policeman learning how to negotiate with hostages while he's sipping some hot cocoa and wearing his slippers. Do you think he's going to remember that if a terrorist points a gun at him? Of course not. He's in a different state. That's why when they go into the army, they drill them to the point of frenzy, the same frenzy they would be in under fire. And what they learn in that frenzy state, they can use in a frenzy state later. Learning is state dependent. So learning to control the states is very important. And I've just shown you how to get more energy. On the advanced program, I'll show you some strategies for getting more relaxed and more focused and more creative. Now, we're ready to learn the four types of reading. The first type of reading is pleasure reading. And as the name implies, it's supposed to be fun, pleasure. Don't skim. You don't want to get to the end of Gone with the Wind in 5 minutes and then read the 4 million page book knowing at the end Brett and Scarlett aren't going to make it. It kind of kills the enjoyment of the story. Another point is, there's a point of diminishing returns between going faster and enjoying what you read. You wouldn't go to the Louvre on a skateboard and look at the Mona Lisa. You wouldn't enjoy it any more than you'd enjoy reading a sonnet in 6 seconds and then say, my God, what a beautiful poem. There isn't enough time to feel. So how do we get higher speed and pleasure reading? It's simple. Imagine for a moment you videotaped a television movie on a commercial TV station. What will you do to your VCR tape when the commercial appears? Fast forward. That's the strategy we use in a novel. How many novels have you read that got boring? Almost all of them have boring sections. Speed up the boring section. Go to your triple speed, watch the topic sentences, the verbs and nouns, and continue to observe what's happening. You'll be going so rapidly you won't be bored, which is better than being bored. When the story appears more interesting and engaging, go back to whatever speed gives you the maximum pleasure. As an example, I read the book The Mists of Avalon, which is a wonderful story about the Knights of the Round Table. But it got very involved with atmospheric descriptions. There was about 10 to 15 pages describing the furniture in King Arthur's throne room, one napkin and fork motif at a time. I read it in 10 seconds. I said, nice throne room, got back to the story. I enjoyed it better. That's a good example of how to speed up. Now, another problem you might have been experiencing was forgetting what you were reading almost as fast as you read it. And I'd like to solve that problem for now for pleasure reading and in a moment for more nonfiction learning type of situations. First, why does it happen? Imagine that there's 1,000 chairs in a room, and every chair is actually a file cabinet. And as you're filing things, you're not keeping track where they go, like they do in a lot of people's companies. And then they say, find the letter. Well, what happens is your brain doesn't know where to look, so it doesn't have any way to find the information. Isn't that how we learn in general? The filing cabinet is your brain. You're throwing information into it throughout the day, but you don't keep track of where you put it. And then when you need it, you can't locate it. What we need is a filing system that's more effective. A visual filing system is perfect. We make a picture, as we could see on the mind map for pleasure reading, of the plot, the character, the atmosphere, the scene. For example, in The Mists of Babylon, Guinevere is with Arthur, and she's with Lancelot. What I do is I picture, what does she look like? What does she sound like? What is the color of her hair? What does her skin feel like? What does her perfume smell like? Like the Paul Revere story I gave earlier, I'm giving as many sensory inputs as possible. And as I'm looking at what she looks like and observing what she's doing, I'm making pictures. Then what I want to remember what she did, the first step is, what does she look like? Because all the pictures are organized on her appearance. And I find exactly what I'm looking for. The same thing could be useful for learning nonfiction for pleasure. The folders now become the who, what, where, when, why, and how, instead of the folders used typically in fiction, theme, plot, atmosphere, and character. Let's look at how we could use this for a famous historical figure, John Kennedy, in the context of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Why did it happen? How did it happen? Where did it happen? What happened? When did it happen? Who did it happen with and to? Now let's consider his tragic journey to Dallas and look at the same questions and look at the difference in the response. Why did it happen? How did it happen? Where did it happen? What happened? When did it happen? And who did it happen to? And notice how our brain sees a completely different context to John Kennedy using Dallas as the backdrop as compared to Cuban Missile Crisis as the backdrop. Notice how much information you were able to pull out of memory effortlessly. Now imagine yourself learning new pleasure information and putting it into the who, what, where, when, why, and how format as you're learning it. It'll make it easier to retrieve and easier to find. The next type of material that I'd like us to learn is how-to books, how to learn something specific. You do skim. Unlike fiction, knowing the ending won't ruin the story. In fact, it might motivate you to work harder if you see the outcomes you would get from learning a skill. You read. What I can help you with the most is the reviewing. How much is enough? I learned Word from a book that was 1,600 pages. That's the word processing program Word. And it took me 90 minutes to learn. Now, I already knew word processing. So what I did on my first skim, remember skimming is 2 to 5 seconds a page, no more than 15 minutes in a book. What does this program do? Not how, what. And then, after I knew what I could be learning, I began to learn. First things first. How do you start a file? How do you save a file? How do you name a file? Things you do every time. Now I'm writing, I want to bold. I know I can, I don't know how. I look it up, it's Control B. I write some more. I want to bold, I don't know how. I look it up, it's Control B. I want to bold again. I look it up, it's Control B. How many times do you think I'm going to have to look it up? After the third or fourth time, I know how to bold. Not because I read it, because I did it. That's the secret. Get the big picture. Find out what it can do. Learn what you need to get started and learn the details if and when they're needed so that you don't clutter your mind up with a lot of information you're never going to need or use. Most people struggle to learn a program like this because they learn so many things they'll never need or use. They forget the few things they actually will need to use and they get frustrated and give up. So, it's a very simple strategy. First things first. Studying. Studying is interesting because we skim first. We always skim 2 to 5 seconds a page. Then we read and then we review. Half your time is spent reading, half the time spent reviewing. Studying is things you need to know temporarily, maybe for a half a year or a year and a half, but not for the rest of your life. And it's not for the great details, but for the big picture and some detail. Next, let's look at technical reading. Again, you skim quickly. With technical reading, it's details that have to be learned for a long time. For example, a lawyer can't say, I meant to object yesterday, I forgot. He had to know at the time that it took place. A pilot can't almost know when the wheels go down on a plane. They do that from time to time at LaGuardia Airport and end up in the water. You have to know ahead of time where you want these things to happen. You can't be reading a book in the middle. With technical learning, where there's lots and lots of details, spend 10% of your time reading and 90% of your time reviewing. As an example, Grey's Anatomy. You don't read Grey's Anatomy, the part on the kidneys, and start crying and say, wow, what a beautiful description of the kidney. The guy writes like Hemingway. No, you learn the names, the parts, and the functions. Reading about it is not going to help you. You already found the names. You don't know them. You have to learn them. You use a study skill and a memory skill to lock in that information. So in calculus and physics, law, medicine, things that have lots of very technical ideas. Once you find them, you stop reading and you use study skills and memory skills. Study skills to make meaning out of them, memory skills to lock them in. And remember, study skills are the skimming skills done much slower. Now, when learning math, there's some extra steps. First, get the big picture. What does this method or procedure actually do? Not how. What does it do? Then copy the examples given in the book step by step, asking yourself, why is this step being done? Why is this the next step? Why is this the next step? Then do the example again without looking at the book, asking yourself, why is this the next step? Why is this the next step? And continue practicing problems so you learn the procedure. And that's how math is done. Now with computers, since more and more reading is done on the computer, here's something that should help. You could set your scroll key so the screen actually moves or scrolls. Then using your mouse, have it go back and forth and down the way your hand was going earlier in the program. And the cursor will go back and forth and down on the scrolling screen so you could quickly skim what's on the screen. When you find something relevant and necessary, block it out with your cursor and then print it. And that'll help you get to material on your computer screen much more rapidly. Now, in each case, with the exception of pleasure reading, here's an extra step. You skim the whole book to get the 50,000-foot view, to see the big picture. You skim each chapter just before reading it for two purposes. To have a fresh map of the territory you're about to wander through to know what's coming before you get to it. And also, equally important, to guesstimate the chunk of information that you could digest before you're overwhelmed with too much new, unfamiliar information. And this will vary from text to text, from chapter to chapter within the same text. For example, if I'm in a book on perceptual psychology, and last year I studied psychophysiology, the chapter on the physiology of perception is a review. I could take a big chunk. I'm not learning it, I'm reviewing it. On the other hand, if I've never learned it before, one paragraph may have so many technical, unfamiliar words that I can't pronounce, I'm overwhelmed. And so I can chunk it down to a chunk as small as a single paragraph or as large as the whole unit and anywhere in between. And you are able to use your skimming to guess how complicated or familiar the material in that particular chapter is, and then you set your skimming, reading, and learning to the size of a chunk you can manage. So you eliminate the problem of forgetting by not taking chunk bites that are too big to learn. Each piece is skimmed, learned, and reviewed in sequence so that you're able to take it in. Your speed doesn't go down. You just take smaller bites of information and process it before moving to the next bite. And that should solve that problem very effectively. Well, now that we know how to read, the real question becomes, what are we looking for? I'm sure many of you had the experience of reading and studying only to find what you studied wasn't on the test or asked at the meeting. And you probably wondered, is there any way to anticipate what those instructors or clients or other people wanted you to learn? And the answer is yes. By learning the four learning levels, I will teach you a strategy for anticipating what other people want you to learn. There are basically four levels on which we learn. The first is the awareness, which is the main concept. The second is the familiar, which is the primary categories in each concept. The third is the studying, which is the main examples in each category. And then there's the technical, which is the finer details. I'm going to give you two paradigms, one for school and one for work. We'll begin with the school first. Most schools, particularly colleges, keep tests on file. It's very important to review old tests. If they don't, I think it's appropriate, given the amount of tuition we pay in many schools today, to go to the professor and say, please, sir, can I see an old test? Or, please, ma'am, can I see an old test? If they say no, I would seriously consider dropping the course. Why would I want to take a course with an instructor who doesn't care whether I learn or not? There are too many good instructors who do care for me to be giving money to one who doesn't. Now that I have my test, what will I do with it? I'm looking to see how many questions fall on each of the four levels. Let's use as an example a biology test. The main concept might be, what is a disease? That's a big concept. The categories. List the five things that cause disease. Bacteria, rickettsia, protozoan, virus, and fungus. Level three is, name the three types of bacteria. Corkscrew shape, round, rod shape. They have more technical names, but we're not really here to learn biology as much as a strategy. Next year, the test might say, name the three types of bacteria. But what if they asked, what are the four types of viruses? List a different type of fungi. Notice what's happened. We're on the same exact level of question, even though the questions change. And that's what stays constant, year after year, term after term. Begin looking at these old tests, and then when you're reading your book, you say to yourself, this is too easy. They never asked this. This is too hard. They never asked this. This is just right. And by the way, what's just right is where you put your lines and stars to study and review. Now, the technical material should be covered in class. Remember earlier how I spoke about the advantages of an author's map? The same is true of a professor. Someone who's spent years in a subject has a much better understanding than someone who's learning it for the first time. It doesn't take a genius to not teach you something difficult, ask you a hard question about it, and surprise, no one knows the answer. All too often, education becomes a game of trivial pursuit instead of educating. The real challenge is an expert taught the subject that was technical so well, everyone got it right. So you want to be very selective about who you pick to study from. Choose instructors who offer you education and insights and care rather than those that are just there to give exams and don't really care about your performance. It's not hard to find them. Ask your friends which teachers really help, and ask your friends which teachers really harm. And you'll very quickly discover everybody gives you the same names on each of the lists, and you'll quickly be able to determine which instructors you want and which you need to avoid. Now, in business, we have a similar paradigm, but instead of tests, we have experience. Suppose I'm into electrical construction, and I want to work in your company. I asked myself, the last time I put in a bid, what kinds of questions did you ask? And I prepare on that level, no higher, no lower. The higher up the level is, the more time it takes to learn. And I could do several proposals if I keep it from going to the technical area. And since you probably don't want the technical, I can do more proposals. What if I don't know you? Then I ask, who have I worked with in this profession who's like you in the past? Based on my experiences with people like you, what can I anticipate you'll probably want me to know for your proposal? What if I haven't got that experience? Well, I join professional associations and have friends in the business. I call up and ask, have you ever worked with this person? And what kinds of questions do people in his industry typically want to know on a proposal? Friends, you never go in cold. Years ago, I lectured with Zig Ziglar. And Zig used to say, if you want to hit a target, you have to know what you're aiming at. Too many of us go into our tests and meetings with a shotgun mentality. We hope if we spray enough pellets against the material, one of the things we sprayed might be asked on the test or at the meeting. I say go in with a laser sight. Know exactly what that person wants based on old tests and experiences with that person or people like them, both your own and those of others, so that you can tightly focus on what has the highest likelihood of being needed and necessary. So now we know how to read. We know what to look for. The next question is, how will we remember all this information we've been finding? Let's begin to learn the different memory strategies. The first strategy draws upon the value of repetition and multiple use of the senses. I developed this for myself while taking the six science courses at one time. Index cards are a powerful memory device. 3x5 and 4x6 cards can be used. One side of a card is a question. The other side of the card is an answer. Suppose I'm learning about zinc. Well, the atomic weight of zinc is 65.37. I certainly don't know the atomic weight of every element, but I can write the name of the element on one side, zinc, and the weight on the other, 65.37. Suppose I'm learning vocabulary in a foreign language, like Spanish. One side says hola, the other says hello. What if I'm learning biology? One side says red-winged blackbird, the other says Agelaus phoenicius. Now I shuffle my cards. Incidentally, I wouldn't recommend mixing in the Spanish with the biology and chemistry, unless you're in Guadalajara and going to medical school. Then it can't be helped. Now we want to randomize those cards. Why do we want to randomize them? The brain learns patterns. And if you keep looking at the cards in the same sequence, you'll only remember the sequence rather than the individual cards. So randomize it. You pick a card, it says hola. What do you think the other side says? Hello. What if you get it wrong? Because sometimes when you're learning 500 words like Agelaus phoenicius in a day, there's a chance you might forget a couple the first go around. Here's where it gets interesting. Take the cards you've got an incorrect answer to and put it on the side and write it out with the correct answer 25 times while saying it aloud. Hola, hello, hola, hello, hola, hello. Here's why. Have you ever tried to spell a word aloud and found you had a problem spelling it, but you could write the word down on a pad that you couldn't spell aloud? How could you do that? If you don't know how to spell it, how can you write it? You're using a different part of your brain. When we speak words. When we write letters. And spelling is more related to letter writing than speaking. And so the memory for spelling is more tightly configured in a part of the brain that controls the movement of the pen, a kinesthetic part of the brain, if you like, rather than the part of the brain that controls speech. Once I realized that, I knew I had a powerful way to multiple sensorily learn things that were giving me trouble. I write them down 25 times, saying them aloud. Writing is kinesthetic. Speaking uses my lips, tongue, and vocal cords. It also gives me an acoustical signal, sound, that hits my ears and stimulates my acoustical area. And I'm still seeing it. Doesn't it make sense? The more brain we use, the more brain we would stimulate, the better we'd learn, and the easier we would recall. That's exactly what happened. Plus, studies show that repetition is an important part of learning. Let me repeat that. Studies show that repetition is an important part of learning. By repeating and simultaneously stimulating multiple senses, we're taking the very information we didn't know and making it more meaningful to our brain. And you take the cards you got incorrect on the first go-around, shuffle them, and repeat them over and over and over till you get everyone right. And you might say, I'm going to have an enormous pile of cards. So what? How long does it take to know that the word hola means hello? That's how long every card should take. And only the ones you don't know will take longer. And then by using more of your brain and its senses to learn those cards, you'll very rapidly put them into permanent memory and no longer have a problem with them. This is an excellent strategy for learning large quantities of information in a very short time frame. Another wonderful strategy is to take advantage of the power of music. I mentioned earlier how we could remember song lyrics, the songs whose lyrics we've never read, effortlessly. Sesame Street and Electric Company took advantage of music and helping youngsters to learn to count and the alphabet and many other things as well. It's been researched and found that music that has one beat per second is ideal for learning vocabulary. An example of that music would be Pachelbel's Canon. And with the music playing on one tape, you have a blank machine with another tape in it, and I'll clap my hands one beat per second. For 4 seconds, you speak what you want to remember, and for 4 seconds, you're quiet. The word hola means hello, and the tape keeps going. Zinc, waves, 65.37, and the music keeps going. Now I've got a tape of my vocabulary, the things I need to know. The beauty of this is I can play the tape while I'm driving in my car, cooking, cleaning, shopping, working out, playing with my dog. Anywhere you want to put a tape in a machine, you could be learning using the music. It's perfect to make downtime time that you don't have to study uptime. And it fills in a lot of the wasted time in a day where you don't have time to learn, like driving from home to work or from work to school. And it turns it into productive time. Now, another powerful tool is pegging. Pegging was discovered by the Greeks and perfected by the Romans. And I'll show you in a moment how to use this. I want you to remember the following 10 items. Pole, socks, wheelbarrow, window, starfish, soda, notes, octopus, line, and toes. Is it safe to say you don't know the whole list yet? But in a moment, not only will you know it, it'll be effortless to remember. Can you count to 10? Hopefully the answer to that question is yes, but that's the only thing you need to be able to do to make this work. We're going to put these ideas into a context. Each one of these will have a number associated with it, and we'll easily be able to lock it in. The number one, doesn't that look a lot like a pole standing on the ground? So when I say one, you say pole. Ready? One. Good, pole. How many socks are you wearing? The answer should be two. So two is socks, and one is pole. How many wheels are on a wheelbarrow? Three. So three is wheelbarrow. Two is socks, and one is pole. A window has four sides, so four is window. One, pole. Two, socks. Three, wheelbarrow. And four is window. Five, how many arms are on a starfish? A starfish has five arms. What's three? Wheelbarrow. And one? One is pole. Notice you're looking for your picture in the context, and that helps you to remember. Six is soda. A six-pack of soda. A six-pack of soda. What was five? Five was starfish. Four, that was the window with four sides. Three was wheelbarrow, two socks, and one pole. Seven, how many notes are in a musical scale? Take a guess. Seven, how many notes are in a musical scale? Well, if you said seven, you're right. So seven is notes. And what was six? Six was the soda, the six-pack of soda. And five? Five was the starfish. How many arms, clue, eight, does an octopus have? Eight is octopus. Seven is notes. And six is soda cans in a six-pack. Rhymes are very helpful in memory. So line rhymes with nine. Line, nine. Line, nine. What was one? Pole. Three, wheelbarrow. And eight? Eight was octopus. One left, toes. How many toes are on your feet? The answer should be 10. Let's go through our list together and see how well we do this time. One is pole. Two, socks. Three, wheelbarrow. Four, window. Five, starfish. Six, soda. Seven, notes. Eight, octopus. Nine, line. And 10 was toes. Let's see how we can actually use this for something practical. You ever park your car at a large sporting event and you can't find it? Where did I park my car? I ran over an octopus. It was section 8. I hit a pole. Section 1. I crushed the starfish. Section 5. By making a picture, what floor am I in my hotel? I have broken toes. I'm on floor 10. By making a picture of one of the objects and exaggerating it, making it really, really funny or very, very unpleasant, some strong emotion associated to it, then I can remember the number associated with that picture very easily and locate things. So this could be very useful for remembering a number. A floor or a section is a good example. Next, we'll learn how to use mnemonics. Our brain essentially has seven chunks of memory to store information, the conscious brain. That's why phone numbers originally only had seven digits. It was tested and found that seven was the maximum number for easy memory. But unfortunately, we often have to learn lists to have more than seven things in them. How do we use a mnemonic? A mnemonic puts a context around the list that is easier for us to recall than the list itself. For example, when you learn the seven colors of the rainbow, you learn the word Roy G. Biv. Each of the letters in the word Roy G. Biv was the first letter of each of the seven colors. Roy, red, orange, yellow, G, green, Biv, blue, indigo, violet. Here's another example. In biology, I had to learn the nine characteristics of a living system. Well, immediately there's a problem. A seven-chunk memory learning a nine-chunk item. So I made a mnemonic, which had no meaning, but organized the nine chunk into an easy-to-remember list. Sim, Igor, Sack. Sim, Igor, Sack. Each of those letters is one of the first letters of each thing on my list. Sim, specific organization, metabolism, movement, Igor, irritability, growth, reproduction, Sack. Specialization, adaptation, and control. It took 2 minutes to learn nine things instead of a half an hour to learn nine things and then quickly forget them. Let's see how we could use mnemonics to learn the five different blood vessels in the circulatory system I described earlier in the program. The five different blood vessel types in the circulatory system are artery, arterial, capillary, venule, and vein. And I have a beautiful picture of an artery right there for you to marvel at. Now, how will I remember this? Well, on the next page, I made up a sentence, which is a mnemonic. Alex always calls voluptuous villains. Now, this was done very consciously. Alex is my son's name. What's the chances of me forgetting my son's first name? Remember how much time we spent on my son's name earlier in the program, how he was named after my grandfather, who was one of the most important people in my life? Chances of forgetting that name are very, very minimal. So Alex is an easy one, and the word Alex begins with the letter A, as does the word artery. Always begins with the letter A, as does the word arterial. Calls begins with the letter C, as does the word capillary. Voluptuous begins with a V, as does venule. And villains begins with a Z, as does vein. Now, I've made a structure to this. The words to the left side, Alex and always, deal with blood vessels moving blood away from the heart, the artery and the arterial. So the left is away from artery and arterial. The words to the right, venule and vein, they are moving blood towards the heart, and in the middle is the capillaries. So I have a symmetry here, away from the heart on the left, towards the heart on the right. I also created another symmetry. The biggest vessel moving blood from the heart is the artery, so that's big. A smaller vessel moving blood from the heart is the arterial. The smallest vessel of all is the capillary. The smallest vessel moving blood towards the heart is the venule. The largest vessel moving blood towards the heart is the vein. So we have big, small, smallest, small, big. The bigs are on the outside, the smalls are in the next position, and in the middle is the smallest. And so we have a size allotment, and we have the moving away from and the moving towards. So now when I look at Alex always calls voluptuous villains, the symmetry and all of these associations that I'm picturing get glued into that picture, making it very easy not only for me to remember the names of the five vessels in the circulatory system, but which ones move blood away from and towards, which are big, which are small, and which is smallest. And look how easily this happens and how effortless, because we've created a pattern. Your brain's primary function is to learn patterns and make them relevant, particularly patterns that help keep you alive. Now, you actually have three different types of memory, short, intermediate, and long-term. The goal is to get as much information into long-term memory as possible. Studies on the brain have shown that it's important to take frequent breaks. In fact, breaks could be as short as every 10 minutes. Let me show you why. The brain in a list maximizes the first one to two things on the list and the last one to two things on the list. So if you're studying in 10 minutes and you learn seven main ideas, the first two will lock right in, the last two will lock right in, and you only have a couple of things in the middle that you have to spend a little more time learning. On the other hand, if you study for a whole hour, you'll have one or two things at the beginning of the list, and one or two things in the end of the list, and dozens of things in the middle that you'll have to struggle to lock in. Lots of short lists with short rests in between are easier to chunk into memory. The brain learns best with lots of frequent rest. During the rest, the brain is able to make more permanent memory associations. When we stop these rests and we continue to stuff ourselves by trying to learn everything at once, by cramming, what often happens is we throw a lot of information, not into long-term memory, but intermediate memory. That's why often we study for tests and meetings. The next day, the same question we asked ourselves the night before is asked, and all we remember is, how could I not remember this? I knew this yesterday. You never actually got it into long-term memory. So chunking is an important part of learning. The memory curve on the next page shows the importance of repetition. If you go to a hospital and they forget a nervous breakdown, they're going to ask your name. If you think that's a multiple choice question, you've had a nervous breakdown. By repetition, how many times in your life did you hear your name? You're supposed to know it. Now, the bottom curve shows that within 4 to 6 hours, approximately 40% of anything you learn is deleted by your brain. But each time you relearn, repetition, you don't delete as much until eventually you don't delete anything and you actually retain it. That's why it's very important to set up your study sessions early in a semester or a project. Remember, reviewing the contents page, the indices, skimming the whole book to guesstimate what you need to do, chunking it down, getting pieces you can manage, and practicing using the different memory strategies over a period of time. That's the right way to learn. While we're on the subject of the right way to learn, here's a note-taking strategy developed by a buddy of mine, Dr. Cooney Beasley. Dr. Beasley has been using the maximum reading technologies in a home-based study school in Dallas. His students that graduate are completing high school in 2.5 years with about 45 college credits. We recently had a 13-year-old graduate into a 4-year college. He's now 14 and attending a 4-year college on a scholarship. We have a 17-year-old graduating with a degree in engineering, a 19-year-old in medical school, and another completing their master's in English. The note-taking strategy that Dr. Beasley has developed is an excellent one that Dr. Beasley and I are going to be putting an entire high school curriculum online together and teach these strategies there. Here's what he came up with. He created a table, 3 columns. Column 1 is the question. Column 2 is the answer. Column 3 is the page that the information was found on. I've given you a couple of pages from a sample of a history lesson. Here's what Dr. Beasley and I do. We have the students skim. They write down in column 1 all of the questions found at the end of the chapter, all of the vocabulary words found at the end of the chapter. They also write down the chapter title and all of the subheadings. All of this goes in column 1. Then we begin reading, looking for the answers to those questions and to the meaning of the vocabulary words. And for the subtitles found, we put a synopsis. What is it about? What did it cover? Think of it as the notes for the main ideas associated with that section. And then in the third column, we write down where we found the information. So if you want to write a report later on, this is also going to be excellent for your index or bibliography. And I want you to practice doing this, and you'll find that it's an excellent way to take notes on any subject. At the end of the reading section, I have performed this activity for you. I've written it completely out. Notice the War of 1812. America fought the English and Canadians. And I gave you a hypothetical page. They won't really have a page here. It's 124. Then it's the attack on Canada. And it goes on and it shows you exactly what I wrote down, what answers I got out of the material, and what page it came off of. And this is the same strategy that you should be following. In my advanced program, I continue doing this in a variety of different subjects. And for those of you who go on to the advanced program, and I highly recommend you do, it'll help you to learn other subjects more effectively. Now let's make the transition from reading to learning. By understanding the difference between data, information, and understanding. Data, as I explained earlier, is just a chunk, like the number 1900. It's often literal. It's given in the text. And the strategy we use for getting data is reading. And the process we just learned of skimming, reading, and reviewing is perfect for inputting data to the brain. Information is more on the implied level. And that's giving relevancy to data through association. We do this by looking for relationships, similarities, differences, patterns, and putting data into a context. Remember Red's red dog, Red? It had a context to it that made the data information. So understanding is the relevancy of the information. It's inferential. It's projecting. Well, now that I have information, what might I do with it? So we ask questions. If this is true, then what are the implications? We ask what if questions. What if this changed? What if this changed? What if I did this differently? What might the outcome be? We're looking at the information, changing the context, and asking ourselves, if we change the context, what might occur then? Remember the analogy we made earlier of Donald Trump's book, The Art of the Deal? What if I use Donald Trump's management and sales and marketing strategies to make my business more profitable? What if I use this strategy at this time differently than he did? What might happen? So it's the questions, the if then, the what if, considering the alternatives that lead to insight and understanding. These are very critical skills, so that we're not just looking at words on a page of text, we're finding the meaning of the words and then the significance and application of the meaning. That's the true mastery of reading. And we're going to have an opportunity now for practicing this. Our last exercise is reading for comprehension. This should be done with a familiar book. You should skim the entire book in under 15 minutes. Read the book at your top reading speed, and then review it. Use study skills and memory skills to lock in the new information, or create a three-column map, such as the one we did in our history lesson, to outline. Might I make an important suggestion? I'm sure many of you have books that you've thought about reading for many, many years. Books that were useful and valuable that you just simply haven't found the time to go back to. They would be the perfect books for practicing comprehension in. And what we're going to have in our comprehension exercise is just a clock running for 30 minutes. And at the end of 30 minutes, you've completed your study. So it's going to tell you to begin and end, and it's going to run for 30 minutes to time you so you can continue reading without watching a clock. When you've completed that exercise, come back and we'll continue. Well, welcome back. Let's apply what we've learned about learning to learning our course. We're going to go through the course, taking notes, creating memory cards, using memory music, pegs, and mnemonics to lock in the key points that you need to retain and aren't sure of. That's an excellent way to make the information relevant to your brain. On the next page, I have some music that I found very useful in creating a learning atmosphere. Playing this music softly in the background while reading and writing will help your brain focus and learn more effectively. I've been using this music for many years and found it to be very helpful, and I believe you'll find it just as helpful for you. I'd like to cover one last skill. How many of you have heard of the book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People? I think most of us have heard of the book. And how many of you have read the book? I think many of you have read the book. What if I asked you, what are the 7 habits of highly effective people? What happens? Your brain goes, well, how am I supposed to know that? Just because I read the book doesn't mean I remember what I read. And that's exactly the problem. We spend a lot of time reading but not remembering or using the information. Let me show you a simple strategy for locking in some of that information. The letter B looks a lot like a dumbbell. Imagine a dumbbell shaped like the letter B hitting you in the forehead. What are you going to remember when you think of your forehead? To be proactive. Be proactive. That was the first habit. The last habit was sharpen your saw. Picture a saw cutting your neck off. We don't actually do this. Remember, we want to make it dramatic. When we think of a saw cutting our neck, what are we going to remember to do? Sharpen our saw. So you see how we can use these mental pictures and emotions to glue information into memory? And there's a reason I brought this up at the end. In the book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, Covey talks about an individual who was trying to saw a tree and after many hours didn't get anything done. He said, well, how about taking out the blade and sharpening it? And the guy turns and said, are you crazy? Look at all the hours I've been working and I haven't gotten anything accomplished. Who's got time to stop and sharpen the blade? And the reason I ask that question is, this isn't the time to stop. This is the time for a beginning. What I would like to see you do now is to practice the 4 different drills for the next 4 weeks. Each week, do one of the 4 drills. Week 1, do exercise 1. Week 2, do exercise 2. Week 3, do exercise 3. And week 4, do the comprehension drill. And then you're ready for the advanced maximum speed reading. Advanced maximum speed reading is designed to take you to the next level. We focused in this program on inputting information, on reading and learning it. Now that you've gotten so brilliant and read so many books, what are you going to do with all that information? The advanced program starts by teaching you several new hand motions that I think you're going to find terrific in speeding you up. It'll teach you brain-based learning strategies for getting in a positive learning state so that you can be more effective. We've already seen that learning is state-dependent. So learning strategies for controlling our emotions by controlling our learning environment are mission critical. Then we're going to learn how to get into a flow state to solve problems and for overcoming writer's block. What most of us need to do after reading is use the information for creativity and often have to write reports. And how many times have you had the experience of looking at a computer screen or a pad and your brain goes dead? You just can't think of what to say or how to say it. In the advanced program, I'll show you how to start the creative flow, sustain the creative flow, and bring it all the way through fruition to get your reports done more rapidly and more effectively, just as I've taught you in this program how to read, remember, comprehend, and learn information more effectively. And finally, the advanced program will give you the opportunity to practice all of these skills from both the basic and advanced program in a variety of subject matter areas so that you can practice it in different types of material. So, you've got a little bit of an assignment now. For the next 4 weeks, you're going to practice the 4 drills so that you can bring your skills to the highest possible level. And then, we've got a date. I'm going to see you in the advanced program. Incidentally, if you have a question or you need some help, you can email me at MrReader, MrReader, at MSN.com with any questions, and I will be happy to try to help you reach your maximum speed reading. As I mentioned before, the world economy has become an information-based economy. Each day, the decisions you make are only as good as the information that you base them upon. by maximizing your ability to read and write and think, you're going to maximize the results that you get from these decisions. How many expensive mistakes have you and others around you made in the last year because of missed or forgotten information? And how much more profitable and successful can you see yourself and they becoming by using the strategies learned in maximum speed reading? I wish you all the best of success and look forward to continuing our relationship in the Advanced Maximum Speed Reading Program. It's been my privilege as the world's fastest reader to share with you the same strategies and methodologies that have made me the best in the world at reading. And I know that each and every one of you is going to reach the maximum speed reading in yourself.
What do you really want out of life? It's a big question. In many ways, it's a very personal question. But when you get right down to it, as different as we all are, the things we're searching for in life are essentially the same. You want to be happy. You want to feel good. You want to enjoy the time you've been given. You want a job you really love. You want the relationships in your life to be healthy and enriching and wonderful. You want enough money so that you don't have to worry about money. You want to develop the skills to do something meaningful with your life, something that contributes to the world in a positive way and fulfills your sense of purpose. By listening to this program, you've discovered that information does exist to help you become skilled in one area of your life. Now you can get the information to become skilled in absolutely anything. Even your spirituality can be strengthened by developing the right skills. And skills, quite simply, are the secret to success. Ask anyone who has ever achieved their dreams. They'll tell you that skills are the key. Many people never learn these kinds of life skills because they're not taught in school. You have to go out and get them on your own. But where do you go? The fact that you're listening to this program now means you're already part of the way there. Why not go all the way? We are the Nightingale Conan Corporation, and for over 40 years, we have been the world's leading producer and publisher of powerful audio information for personal development. But we're much more than just a company. For tens of thousands of satisfied customers around the world, we're their partner in success, a one-stop source for ideas, information, and inspiration to create an extraordinary life. No matter what you want to accomplish in your life right now, we have a program that addresses your needs and interests. Whether you're looking to redesign your business, master powerful investing techniques, conquer procrastination, build a better vocabulary, enhance your conversational skills, or raise your consciousness spiritually. Our vast audio program library contains hundreds of titles covering every subject in the personal development spectrum. Our authors are world-renowned experts in their fields. And our information is delivered to you via the most powerful and convenient method available, audio. Audio learning is today's fastest growing media for training, education, and self-improvement. And the reason is simple. Audio programs give you the one thing you need more than anything else, time. Unlike books, classes, or even internet research, which force you to find or make time for learning, audio programs actually put more time into your life by turning the hundreds of hours a year you spend driving, commuting, or just lying around into valuable opportunities to build skills, master new ideas, and increase your knowledge. And because audio programs are able to deliver information on a powerful subconscious level, learning is almost effortless. The average person spends at least an hour a day in their car. That's at least 7 hours a week, or even more, 365 hours in a year. That's incredibly valuable time you could now spend learning, listening to a powerful Nightingale Conant program. You could literally turn your car into a university on wheels. However you happen to come to our family, you've received a great gift. Many people never discover this information, but somehow, for some reason, it did find you. Now, you can become the author of your own destiny by developing the skills that will help you create the life you want. And you can do it with the power of audio learning from the Nightingale Conant Corporation. Call us now today, toll-free, at 1-800-525-9000. That's 1-800-525-9000. And talk to one of our program consultants. They can help you find the perfect program for your current interests and needs. You can also visit us on the web at www.nightingale.com. That's www.nightingale.com. Happiness, satisfaction, a great family, good health, real career fulfillment, financial peace, a strong, focused life purpose. You know the things you want out of life, and you know how to get them. Take that next step. Call 1-800-525-9000 or visit us at www.nightingale.com.